The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
You don't produce a Kieran Kilkenny or an Oisín Mullen. You don't produce them overnight. They take time, takes a lot of work, massive loss for his club, but he's meant for professional sport.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
All right, we are nearing the end of the month. It's the 29th. How's your mow coming along, Nathan?
Well, I'm just going to appear out of nowhere on the last day of November, so tomorrow, and I'm just going to do what you've been trying to do, Jerry. I'm going to shave off all the beard, and out of nowhere, I'm just going to come in and steal the glory.
Well, you should.
I'm going to be the Cristiano Ronaldo of off the ball, where I do little or nothing, but then right at the end, I pop up with the glory.
Totally useless, kind of lazy, but good at one thing. Is that it?
Sort of fits in, but like very, very, very good at that one.
All right, if you want to get involved this morning, 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. It's myself and Nathan. We'll have Owen back with us tomorrow. And you can also leave a comment on the YouTube stream. We're going to get to your comments on the YouTube stream a little bit earlier than usual this week. We're particularly interested in your takes on the situation at Manchester United. If you're a Steven Gerrard fan, you know, he's got 100% records. Perhaps they're the dark horses to win the league this year.
You think Villa out of nothing, they're going to do a Roy Keane at Sunderland, a slow start, but then just unbelievable winning record and Aston Villa become contenders.
I mean, I don't want to get carried away, but as long as I've been a Villa fan, all the way back, I remember listening to Five Live grainy Tuesday night football where it'd be nil all until the 90th minute at Selhurst Park and then one of their centre backs would pop up with a header. So for whatever reason, Crystal Palace was a graveyard and has always been a graveyard for Villa, and he flounces in and wins 2-1. And they do their last-minute concession, but it's all right because we've got a little bit of, I don't know.
You've got John McGinn.
Am I wrong to get
curling in wonder goals?
Carried away. Yes, of course I am. But isn't the whole point, shouldn't we all be getting carried away whenever we get the chance to be carried away? Especially now. Has COVID not taught you anything? It's like when there is an opportunity, a tiny little moment for you to escape everything that's going on, seize it.
Well, after the 24 hours that everyone had on Thursday and Friday where we, you know, thought the sky was about to fall in, I think when you get a little bit of Aston Villa glory 24 hours after that, why not take it? He's done alright, Steven Gerrard, hasn't he? Turns out this Jacob Ramsey kid in the middle of midfield, one of the Ramsey family, I think there's three of them.
Yeah, they're all at Villa.
He's pretty goddamn impressive. Yeah. He made some big decisions. He dropped Danny Ings. Danny Ings was a strange signing. I know he was coming on the cheap, relatively on the cheap, and you know, Tottenham wanted him. It seemed like a real coup and they had the money, but you had Ollie Watkins. Two together.
Ollie Watkins is a little bit flaky. There are times when Watkins' finishing isn't as good as it seems when you just watch the highlights, where there'll be four or five chances a game and he'll score one or two and you're like, wow, he's doing really well. And look, maybe I think there was an insurance policy, and also they thought that you know, they're going to play 45, 50, 55 games. They'll make big long runs in the cup competitions. That didn't last.
Well, there is, and there's the insurance policy of actually Ollie Watkins does go and score 25 goals this season, and somebody goes and sign Ollie Watkins for 50 million.
Yeah, and you've got
Danny Ings there.
Yeah, they're totally different players. You've got to, and that was the problem with Dean Smith, was like trying to fit all these things together. It didn't look like the recruitment was done with just the manager and his style of play in mind.
Well, without going all John Charles on it, you know, if you're not picking the players, what are you doing?
Well, you're getting fired. Well. And you're ending up at Norwich, where it looks like he's also started really well. So now, not great for Andrew Omobamadeli, who isn't getting a sniff under the new manager. But we'll see. He does recognise game. Just doesn't play the youngsters a lot.
Well, he's brought Billy Gilmore back in.
Yeah, not his youngster.
But still, Billy Gilmore, maybe the best young player, maybe the best 18-year-old in world football. And Daniel Farke's like, nah, not for me. Not really my gig to give you some game time.
Yeah, all right. OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. It is time for the performance rankings. Oh, I'll tell you what's going up first. Yeah, good. Well done. We're going to do our performance rankings right now. We have sports pages at 8:10. Andy Mitten's going to join us at 8:30. A slightly more positive interview this time with Andy than some of the ones we've been doing recently. Alan Quinlan's going to join us at 8:50. A bizarre weekend of rugby. Brilliant if you're Ulster. Very worrying if you're Munster, and what the hell kind of performance did Leinster give? But if you're Connacht, you're like, hang on a second, we have this code cracked. The FA Cup final, we're going to talk about St. Patrick's Athletic victory on penalties against Bohemians at 9:10. Ireland versus Georgia is live tomorrow night on Off the Ball. Nathan's going to be doing commentary on that one, so we'll talk to him about that. And Sunday papers at 9:30. Time for the performance rankings.
You know, that wasn't an All-Ireland winning performance.
Probably should have won the game based on their second half performance.
Is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not.
OTBAM's performance rankings with Gillette.
I'm scratching my head. Our performances was just lacked that intensity.
Boom. Right. Here are the performance rankings this week. In the red, we have Ronaldo on Everton. We have the Ultimate Rugby Championship. I was struggling with the name of that one. In orange, it's the McGraths and Co. In green, the Hurlers and the Footballers and the Camogues. And St. Patrick's Athletic also in green. So we're going to start with Cristiano in red.
Dropped. You can't drop Cristiano Ronaldo, but Michael Carrick, the bravest manager of his generation, did just that. Manchester United can't even do their little half press that they tried to do yesterday with Cristiano Ronaldo in the side. Left him out.
You did commentary in this game, right? So you saw the whole thing.
I saw the whole thing.
Did you expect Ronaldo to be dropped? Because we've got a new show kicking off the weekend and Buig was sitting in your seat and I was like, oh, maybe Carrick drops Ronaldo. He said, Carrick's not going to drop Ronaldo. How could he possibly do that? And he did.
Lo and behold, he did. Yeah, it was a big decision considering...
I thought he was going to because it's a real, I'm my own man, I'm a human being. I'm not just a patsy for the club.
And it makes sense against Chelsea, of all teams, where
you give yourself a chance of victory. And also, you know the next manager's going to do it anyway. So you may as well get in. Look, I could be a very important part of your crew here. I might be the next manager in waiting here. Ranić comes in.
Jobs for the boys, Jer.
Those 2 or 3 years.
Do we know if Michael Carrick's a good coach? We have no idea. But everything suggests he's not. Everything he's been part of suggests he's not a very good coach.
It's hard though when your star is overshone by Jose Mourinho and then Solskjaer, who's like, how does this job work? I'm not sure. Let's have the crack.
Listen, they had a one-all draw against Chelsea where they were absolutely and utterly dominated by Chelsea for the entirety of the game. David De Gea, if he doesn't make that save from Callum Hudson-Odoi early on, this could easily end up in another 4-5-0. Chelsea had it all except in that final third where nothing really clicked. There's no Timo Werner. Got to remember, Chelsea were missing pretty much half of what I would say. If they have a first-choice 11, half them aren't there. Kante is out injured. Kovacic isn't there. Mason Mount is on the bench. Havertz is on the bench. Romelu Lukaku's on the bench. Christian Pulisic's on the bench.
Why did he start all those players on the bench? Because they're not quite...
A variety of different reasons. Injuries and all sorts of things going on. Which meant that United start with three holding midfielders. So sometimes we've one, sometimes we've two, and this time we end up with three. And actually, all three of them, I thought, did quite well. But it was a Chelsea midfield of Ruben Loftus-Cheek and Jorginho, which is a very different beast from a Chelsea midfield of Jorginho, Kante, and Mason Mount.
Yeah.
So I think it worked out in his favour. Like, did they press? Jeez, this wasn't a Chelsea or Liverpool press. It was glaringly obvious in the first half that United weren't quite sure what to do. Bruno Fernandes is half pushing up. More often than not, they ended up with this low block where they're sitting way back and happy to let Chelsea play in front of them. And this, maybe it's a sign of where Manchester United are, despite all their incredible attacking talent, that this is what they need to do now against the very best teams, is be defensive. But they weren't I didn't think they were a counter-attacking team by any stretch of the imagination. Yesterday, I guess their goal, I guess, on a sort of counter-attack by
it's a
horrible, horrible error by Jorginho, where I think Thomas Tuchel says the...
He lost it in the...
Floodlights.
Right?
Floodlights.
Wow, was that much of a hoof?
It was.
Agricultural.
Whew, right up there from Bruno Fernandes. It's a big decision by Michael Carrick. There's no question. Like, he says he spoke to Cristiano Ronaldo.
We had a good chat.
Was completely accepting. And maybe he was proven right, because I thought actually United were a lesser team in the last half an hour when Ronaldo came on. Though, you still felt in those last few minutes when it got really frantic that he's just going to score here, isn't he? He's just going to score. And he stormed straight off down the tunnel. I'm not sure, was it because he was having a row with the referee, or was it that his teammates never got the ball in the box in those last couple of minutes? It came out on the left, it came out on the right.
He does storm off anyway, though. That's his thing. That is his shtick, apart from when he's given his...
Well, he was storming off then as well, I think.
She got to him. That was the issue. Just briefly before we talk more about Ronaldo, what was Marcus Rashford doing when the goal was scored? He's offside the whole way through, and if Sancho passes it to him, maybe he's distracting the keeper. But surely the keeper knows he's offside too. So the keeper's looking at him going, I'm going to take the risk that this guy's offside and just focus on you.
It does work though, because Sancho gives the eyes enough times where Mendy...
He's given the eyes so long, and he's like, what are you doing? You're offside.
Marcus Rashford's always offside. But this was just a very strange situation where there was once or twice when, you know, there's the 10 seconds that Jadon Sancho's inside the Chelsea half where maybe the ball is slightly ahead of him. But just stay back. And also,
it's not the best angle he's giving.
No.
If Sancho, well, you're going to play in an offside position, but even if the ball's ahead, he's probably going to end up playing it slightly behind you.
Yeah.
And you make a mess of the whole thing. And this is a viral moment for Manchester United, a time when they could really avoid having any of those.
So, Ronaldo getting dropped. This is the end for Ronaldo?
It's clearly not the end. But
interim
maybe,
coach coming in. But maybe
it is the end in games like this for Cristiano Ronaldo. Like, maybe he's your guy for playing, you know, Aston Villa or West Ham, or, well, maybe not even West Ham at this stage, but those teams outside the top three or four, those teams who can press high like Rangnick would want Manchester United to do, maybe Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't play or doesn't start in those games. Does he accept that? Maybe right now he says, of course, yes, I'll do whatever's best for the club.
But it's the end of him.
Sitting on the bench in Manchester over Christmas.
Next season he is gone. This is the end. It's a 1 year thing for Cristiano Ronaldo. The clock started ticking and it accelerated with the decision at the weekend and the fact that they got a better result against Chelsea than they have done against City or Liverpool. Like, it's hard, regardless of the quality of the performance, right? The clock is ticking on Ronaldo and he will not be a Manchester United player next September.
Well, who's the manager going to be next September? Like, is this appointment of Ralf Rangnick a seismic change in how the club is run? That we are bringing in the visionary of German football who's going to have an influence on everything we do football-wise for the next 3 or 4 years. So he will be the one who decides the manager.
If it's not, what's the point of it?
But this is Manchester United. So it's the one club where you would look and think, there's a possibility that there may be no point to it.
You have to assume that what's going to happen.
Mm.
That Rangnick has been brought in to inject his DNA and the everything that we've read about him and heard about him over the last week, that or for the last 4 days, that he is going to do that to Manchester United and that there's not really room for Ronaldo in that. They might keep him they might do a deal with him to keep him up until after the World Cup and let him go in the January transfer window after the World Cup if they qualify, which isn't a guarantee at the moment because they're in the same group as Italy. So I don't know. This could be the end of Ronaldo at Manchester United.
Ronaldo's got 10 goals. 10 goals already this season.
I know, but it's not to say that, like,
Greenwood wouldn't have 10 goals if Mason Greenwood was
playing. Or they signed Vlahovic or somebody. You know, like, would you be terribly surprised to see them sign a shit-kicking 22-year-old, 21-year-old who likes to run from the front and is good on the ball? And, like, that's what I would expect them to do.
Well, everything that Rangnick seems to be about is anti what Manchester United have been about. So the next few months are going to be the most interesting. And maybe till the end of the season, because I don't know who you can sign in January. Can you sign enough good young players to be able to fully implement his system? But United have been a sort of form of Galacticos. He wants young, energetic, enthusiastic players. United have been anything but that.
Yeah.
But we haven't even seen him there yet. So this thing of, oh, he had an influence yesterday, and Gary Neville was suggesting that he almost picked the team and it was his decision. And listen, maybe Carrick knows what's coming down the track and that he wants to get that process started. Again, like, this was not a high-pressing gegenpress from Manchester United.
You have to assume that Carrick and Rangnick have had a conversation, right? And maybe Rangnick floated the notion of, let's see what the team looks like without Ronaldo. And that's a test. And Carrick passed the test, did what he was told.
You're my guy.
Well, you know, like, Rangnick's not going to get 14 coaches in who are all his guys again between now and the end of the season, because he's not staying in that role, or is he? Does he secretly covet that role?
But this is, again, like, we're very early in the season. We're only a third of the way through the season. If, which is not beyond the realms of possibility at all, Ralf Rangnick comes in, Manchester United finish inside the top four and win the Champions League, what are you doing then? Oh, thanks. It's the Jupp Heynckes situation at Bayern Munich, and we've got Mauricio Pochettino lined up. So,
well,
you're an old guy. You don't even want to be coaching on the pitch
every
day.
Well, I mean, maybe what he does at that point is he escapes into the background and goes, I'll take, you're going to double my agreed previous salary. I'm now going to 5 million a year or whatever it is to be your director of football, and I get to pick the manager for the next decade because I'm now the genius here. So you become unsackable and you get a job for life. You basically become the new Ferguson, except, you know, you're more involved at that stage. And thanks very much. Ego would decide that he wants to work.
It's so interesting to see how this develops, because Rangnick clearly has an enormous reputation, and United seemed to be interested before, Chelsea were interested, but his track record is in developing players. His track record is bringing players up several levels. He hasn't gone into a dressing room like Manchester United's before and had to make an impact. maybe he is such a good coach and everything suggests he is, that that isn't going to be an issue. And actually, maybe that Manchester United dressing room is perfect for him when you take away Cristiano Ronaldo. That there's still, like, there's still loads more to come from Mason Greenwood. There has to be more to come from Marcus Rashford, who's just massively stagnated. Jadon Sancho's still primed to be educated. There's lots of players in there, actually, good young players that you can make better.
Well, those three alone, you could press with them if they were taught how to do it. And it seems like everybody says Tuchel turned Chelsea around in one training session. Remember that boring nil-all draw, and it was like, oh, this is really boring. The clock is ticking, was the headline. Clock stopped ticking. Henry Winter's clock seems to have stopped on Thomas Tuchel's time at Chelsea for the moment anyway. I suspect that Chelsea's playing squad was actually better and deeper than this one, and it was more balanced than the current squad at Manchester United.
It was, but I think that's the brilliance of a good coach, in that look at the left-hand side is the most obvious example. Like Marcus Alonso, every summer seems to be on his way out of Chelsea. Comes in.
He's a good player, though.
He is a good player, but I think nearly all those Manchester United players are good players. Like, look at Luke Shaw's level from last season and maybe add something to that compared to what he's been this year.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they do have a problem probably at the back where if you want to press...
The midfielders aren't as good.
The midfielders aren't as good, but... And they have a problem at the back if you want to press high and Harry Maguire's
there's
your centre
no pace.
Half. Maybe you have a bit of an issue there. But I think...
Does Eric Bailly have pace?
Like, he seems to have quite a bit of pace. He certainly has a turn, I think, compared to...
Well, you know, is it possible that... Like,
Harry Maguire gets dropped.
Goes, well, he comes in and goes, OK, Bailly and Lindelof, you're my two, right? Lindelof's going to be the smart guy. Bailly's going to be the fast guy. And here's the combination of them. And Lindelof sets the agenda for everybody. Because, Lindelof's a decent footballer.
Yeah.
Is he any worse than Harry Maguire? I don't think he is.
But maybe not as good with the ball at his feet as Harry Maguire.
Is he not?
But again, I just think... The brilliance of Tuchel is that a good coach doesn't care about any of this. He just picks whatever team and actually has a way of managing it that, like, nobody at Chelsea has thrown their toys out of the pram. Like, nobody. And he constantly rotates the
team.
Well,
we certainly haven't heard about them, and they've won the Champions League, so if you do, exactly. No one's listening. That's the bit where... And the trouble at Man United is that Ronaldo will throw his toys out of the pram pretty quickly and we'll start hearing about it. Or a deal will be done.
A backdoor deal will be done to get him
to go somewhere else.
This guy, what's he ever won? This coach, what's he ever won? He's leaving Cristiano Ronaldo on the bench.
And maybe... Do they let him go mid-season?
Nah. Ronaldo's not going in January. There's a lot of goals to be scored.
You can go to Barcelona.
There's a lot of handy goals to be scored.
You can go to Barcelona. There is a lot of handy goals to be scored.
It's going to be the Divock Origi of Manchester United.
There might not be a lot of football to be played. That's your Twitter handle for the day. The new Divock Origi. 7:47, time for us to move on. Rafa Benitez is in the red this morning.
Yeah, going to be a strange...
Rafa Benitez below Steven Gerrard in the table at the moment.
It's been a disastrous run for Everton. No wins in 7, 1 win in 9. Remember, they started the season unbeaten in 4, and everyone was obviously putting it down to the Rafa effect.
Champions League.
His ability
stadium.
To work with the likes of Damari Gray and Andras Townsend, who they spent absolutely no money on. Kumain scoring goals, making an impact. But it's fallen apart. I think a large reason, like several clubs, is that the amount of injuries that are happening in the Premier League is just insane. Every game you watch, there seems to be 4 or 5 players missing from every team through injury. And Everton, right down the spine, have lost their key players. Yerry Mina, Doucouré, and Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Doucouré was one of the best players in the Premier League for the first month of the season. Gets injured. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, you know, we've seen how he's developed over the last couple of years. And also seems to be able to bring the best out of Richarlison alongside him. And they're a bit of a mess at the back without Yerry Mina.
You're just... Well, we want to put this on the record. You're a massive Richarlison fan to the point where you tipped him up to...
I still think when he's at his best, I would have had Richarlison as the best player outside the top 6 for a long time. And I think the fact that he's Brazilian sort of is held against him when we look at work rate. Like, that's not there anymore. You look at what Rafinha does at Leeds and what Richarlison does well. Like, he works his ass off when he's in the mood, when the team is going well. Maybe he's not the character who, in a time like this...
We've heard that Man United are in for Richarlison, and that's going to be one of those things that just gets done over the next...
Well, I think it'd be a great signing for Manchester United, because I remember when he came over first and you're watching him in front of Seamus Coleman, you're thinking, this won't be a particularly happy partnership. But actually, it turned out that
compared to
Theo Walcott...
Where would Richarlison play in the Man United
team? What system is he going to play? Surely he's not going to play... He's not going to play the 3 midfielders in every game for Manchester United. So,
well, he might until he replaces the 3 of them. Do you know?
And then just have 2 attackers, which means you're leaving 4 of them on the bench.
Well, it's 4-3-3, right?
But Fernandez is one of them as well. So you're only playing two more alongside Fernandez.
Is Fernandez on his way out?
Again, if you think back to Fernandez at Sporting Lisbon and he was sort of a one-man show and he seemed to be able to cover every blade of grass then.
So you think you can use him in that?
I think you can. Okay. I think you can. You can turn Bruno Fernandez around from what he's been over the last 6 months, which is somebody who throws his arms in the air an awful lot and spends a lot of time giving out about things. But I think I do think Richarlison has that potential to play for Manchester United or any of the teams, and to be part of a team that presses high. So
it's either going to be Christmas or the New Year or the summer transfer window.
The problem for Rafa Benitez is the style of football. That when things are going well, you just about get away with it. In modern football, Everton are looking around at all the other teams. They're looking at Liverpool. They're watching the excitement and they're thinking, like, we've got a busted flush. We've got a guy who is not going to entertain us in any way, who, because we're not getting results, isn't going to bring us silverware. So basically, what's the point?
Yeah.
And that's the problem for any of these, like, negative managers, which is, you know, he makes say he's a pragmatic manager. But, like, this is Everton. Like, Jesus. Every single season, the same story, these sort of runs. Seamus Coleman out doing his post-match interviews. Got to look at ourselves. Can't look at the manager. They've gone through every different type of manager.
They should look at the manager.
Same old thing.
Well, they haven't. Have they got a young, progressive, good manager who wants to play good football? I forget now, have they?
Well, they had Roberto Martinez, who actually did quite well.
Yeah, well, I mean, who they complained about at the time, he wasn't getting up to the level Liverpool were at. But I think they would take him back now. They would take that run of success back.
Yeah.
That style of playback. Has there been anybody else since? I'm trying to think.
Big Sam? No. Marco Silva? No.
I don't even remember. Was Marco Silva there long enough to...
He wasn't very good, Marco Silva. Had a good agent, though, clearly. A very good agent. But, yeah. They've a lot of injuries in key positions, and I think if they had kept all them, it'd be a different scenario. But then you could say the same thing last season. I remember watching them on the first day of the season. They beat Spurs, and you were looking at their midfield at the time again, where they had Alan and Doucouré and Gomez and James Rodriguez was playing. I think, geez, this Everton team, James Rodriguez and Richarlison either side of Calvert-Lewin, like, could finish inside the top four. And then Alan gets injured and it just all falls apart.
Yeah. So how bad is this going to get? Is he going to get
fired?
It's
going to be a bizarre scenario on Wednesday night, isn't it, for the Merseyside derby, where he's booed onto the pitch by his own team supporters, but the away team supporters are all going wild for him.
So Liverpool fans are delighted by what's happening.
Well, like, it's perfect scenario. He's always going to be beloved at Anfield, for
especially now
winning the Champions League,
and then taking Everton down.
He goes and destroys Everton. Like, couldn't be a better scenario. They've got Liverpool and Arsenal over the next week. Like, some of the results.
Is he getting fired?
5 at home to Watford. The way Liverpool are playing at the moment, at this, like, the way these things are written in the Stars, they'll beat Liverpool 1-0 again and, you know, derail Liverpool's title hopes. Or Liverpool just keep going the way they've been going, and think back a couple of years ago, they scored 5 in the Merseyside derby around this time of the year, that they do that again, and then you're
very dangerous territory.
Then he's, I remember Everton have a load of money, so yeah, they can afford to make these changes.
They have a lot of money. They didn't use the load of money in the summer.
No, they brought in Gray, Townsend and Solomon Rondon, who follows Rafa wherever he goes and doesn't score too many goals. No, presumably they're looking at the previous summers where they spent an insane amount of money and not much of it worked out on the likes of Alex Iwobi, Gylfi Sigurdsson and players like that who've not really done much for the club since they came in.
So Palace have 16 points, Brentford have 16 points, Villa have 16 points, Everton have 15 points. And then, okay, so Burnley are on 9. They're 6 clear of the relegation zone at the moment. Obviously between them is Southampton, Watford.
And will be relegated.
Well, somebody's getting sucked back into that relegation.
It won't be Everton. No, they'll have enough. Now, if somehow none of these players return and Calvert-Lewin seems to have one of these injuries that it's a little bit longer. Now, I know they're hoping to have him maybe back in the squad for Wednesday. I think if Calvert-Lewin comes back, he could transform Everton.
Because he will score goals.
He will score goals. And as I say, I think, geez, he's so bloody good in the air. Like, he is one of the best in the league in the air, if not the best. And not even that, like, you watch the leap on him. You talk about Cristiano Ronaldo and the various videos and the science behind how high he can jump. Calvert-Lewin, I'd say, can nearly do the same. You watch him, the way he chests the ball down above somebody's head, holds it up, brings Richarlison into it. Richarlison shows enough to finally fulfil that potential.
We'll see. Right, so is Rafa getting sacked?
Yeah, if they concede 5 or more against Liverpool,
He's getting sacked.
Okay. All right, there you go. That's another hostage fortune this morning. In the orange, it's the United Rugby Championship. It was supposed to be a big weekend. We were supposed to get the really first opportunity to see how the Irish teams were going to fare against the South African teams. Unfortunately, the new variant intervened. The golf tournaments were kind of stopped in the middle of the tournament. Some people finished them out. Some people came home. It didn't seem like a... Some people... There's stories of how, like, there's actually a European Tour charter. It sounds like it might still be in the air from the reports. It was like, was refused permission to land in...
Well, it was... how do these states work? I'm not quite sure, but the charter was put on by DP World, which is a subsidiary of Dubai. They were flying to Dubai... And Dubai said, nah, you're not landing here.
All right,
no, they hadn't actually taken off, so they were, it wasn't
okay,
the basic scenarios where you're lads. How much how much fuel have we got left? Somebody please take
I
us
heard
in.
Too.
Yeah, listen, obviously this all blew up on Thursday and Friday pretty quickly and scared the bejesus out of all of us and might still be scaring the bejesus out of an awful lot of people, particularly if you're stuck in South Africa. The golfers, the Irish golfers all withdrew straight away, so did a load of the English golfers. Got the hell out of Dodge. Tournaments ends up being cancelled after 36 holes anyways. One of the players, I think it was Ashley Chester, is getting married, but decided not to withdraw for the tournament. Was in contention. Tournament gets called off. He finishes inside the top three, gets an invite for the Open. So at least he is that. You know, may not get married, but there's all sorts of horror stories from players who are still stuck there, who've been trying to get out, who've been spending thousands on flights, and then are told that the flight isn't allowed to take off because the country they're going to is banned flights. It seems as though there's another charter that is going to get them somewhere. And then you have the situation with Munster, which just seems to go from bad to worse, where, again, find themselves right in the heart of it, looking to get out. Player tests positive, which means they're back in their hotel, and seems to be just a lot of confusion as to when they can come home, and it's going to have severe knock-on effects for the rugby calendar. Obviously, we know, in context, it's not that important, and games can be arranged and all of that. But in the short term, in the rugby context, there's the problem for the Champions Cup, because Munster are due to play in, what, 10, 12 days' time. Hard to see how they can do that now, regardless of what happens, considering they're going to have to quarantine when they come back. So maybe push those games back into January, February. There's also the issue for this tournament, which I know you have been one of the biggest fans of, actually. Not big enough fan to actually figure out what the name is. Give me the name.
The ultimate fighting competition? The United Rugby Championship.
But where do they go? Like, what commitments can you make for teams to go to South Africa, maybe, and we all hope this settles down.
They should
down.
Just buy the Ultimate Rugby app and rename it Ultimate Rugby Championship, shouldn't they? Like, it's a good app. It's exactly what they need.
Lots of people have it already. It's a good business model there, Ger.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
You've got shares in this? This is some sort of insider trading?
I don't.
Should we edit this out?
No, let's keep going. I think it's a good idea. Right. You can have that one for nothing, lads.
I guess the only option is that if all of this settles down, and hopefully it's not as severe as everybody fears it might be, that you have to do what they were planning to do last year. You bring all the South African sides up and you base them in England,
yeah.
You base them in Italy, and you just get the games played. Because even last week they were signing new television rights deals for over in the Far East. That this is a tournament that certainly, it seems, the television companies and the broadcasters are very interested in.
Well, it was sold as something that had the potential to be the best rugby league in the world, right? You were up against the top 14, and you were breaking up the power base or the Southern Hemisphere unions by taking the best teams and putting them up against the best teams in Ireland, Scotland and Wales and the Italian teams. And there should have been, and there's a potential for some games, but like it's not that convoluted, but it's, you know, it's a new structure of a season, and now we're not going to see how that structure actually works. Does it have knock-on impact? When were the South African team supposed to join the European Cup? Is it next season or is it the season after?
What? The South African teams are joining the Champions Cup? What?
Yeah, that was part of the...
Nah, you can't have that.
Why not? What's the point of them being in the league if they can't qualify?
They're bleeding obvious.
Well, you just rename it.
Yeah, but you're changing the entire history of the competition.
I mean, it's a brand new competition. It's about a wet week old.
So you're saying Munster haven't won a current competition ever?
Well, they have.
It's the European Cup.
Yeah, it's the European Cup.
It's not the European Cup. The South African teams are in it.
The European Cup is like the mid-90s.
I don't care. It's still the same.
You're older than us.
Still the same trophy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you'll keep the same trophy. You'll just now have the Stormers. Okay.
I'm all for bringing the South African sides and giving them a chance in the Ultimate Fighting Championship.
What's the point of the Ultimate Fighting Championship if you can't use it to qualify for the Olympics? Like,
because they've got their own tournament.
They don't, though, anymore.
They do. They've the Ultimate Rugby Championship. That's got to be the pinnacle of what they can achieve.
And now,
you can't bring them into the European Cup.
Here, this tournament is great, but actually, we're just going to ignore you for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks of the season, and we're going to go over here. It's actually the best tournament. You can't play in it because you might win it. We like you. We don't like it that much.
Now, we do. I should be careful what I say here. And right now, obviously, I'm, you know, it's not the most attractive proposition, but we obviously do broadcast and have the rights for the European Champions Cup. So the fact that there might be suddenly away games in South Africa,
you're like, woo! I always wanted to taste the Stellenbosch straight from the tree.
Yes, yeah, can't do that one off tube, unfortunately.
Right,
this is
so
an outrage.
Okay, well, that was a tangent. Next is in green. It is the McGraths and Co. So this is Lochmore Castellini on a roll. Let's have a listen to one of the McGraths here. This is Brian, the goal scorer, on the pitch with Stephen Gleeson of Tip FM.
Feeling like to win the double in Tipperary, like, you know, you had to hurl all the way.
Stephen, I can't put it into words. I don't think any of us can believe what we're after doing. Like, it's unbelievable. Every week, just playing with those lads, there's no better feeling. It's some enjoyment. Oh, I can't never enjoy the club championship as much. Every week out with the boys, no better feeling, and we absolutely love it.
You had to work so hard to get there, and you kept going, and you know, every player fighting week on week, you know, everything for that moment to see, can you achieve this, what you've done?
Oh, I do it all again. Everything we've gone through the last 2 years, do it all again last year, it makes it even more special. Winning with these boys is unbelievable. And Noel said in his speech, it's his proudest moment, and I'm absolutely delighted for him. No one else deserves that more, and by God, to play with them lads there week in week, it's unbelievable, it's so enjoyable, and I absolutely love it.
So that's Brian McGrath, the goal scorer, at talking to Stephen Gleeson of Tip FM in the aftermath. So they beat Turles Sarsfield in the replay of the hurling final yesterday. They won the football the week before, and now obviously they're going to go forward to the Munster Championship in hurling and football as double champions. And Stephen Gleeson, who you saw there, tweeted yesterday, 18 cousins of the famed McGrath clan of Lochmore played in county finals last weekend. 17 won medals with drum football, drum camogie, Lochmore, that's Noel John, etc. Spare thought for Therese Short, who was the only cousin who didn't win a medal. At least her sister Michelle did.
Jez.
They appear to be in different jerseys, so they must have been playing up against each other.
Yeah, there was an article last week of the cousins going up against each other as well. Yeah, they're kind of dominant down there. And John McGrath scored a last minute goal in the football final to win that one. Scores a last minute point. And then there's this almighty scrap at the end of the game where Turles are trying to get into it. Yes, they're not a shambles, just a little scrap.
Right.
Where everyone's scrapping for the ball, and out of nowhere, John McGrath emerges and the full time whistle blows.
And he saved the day.
Saved the day.
That's not bad. So that's pretty special. And I mean, it turns out players can play games. Play a lot of games
all the time.
You can
week after week after week, and enjoy it.
They'd prefer to do that than training.
Mm.
What's going on? What you know? Oh, you can't have more than 3 games in 10 weeks. Anyway, look, congratulations, because that is an incredible story, and it's the type of stories that, again, in the olden times when people talked about a split season, oh, you're handing over the whole calendar year to all the other sports. And now it's all going to, you know, I'll never talk energy at all. It's like everybody's talking about these, you know.
Do you know what I discovered at the weekend, Jared? This, I think, did it go under the radar? I don't know if it was mentioned on OTBAM, maybe because you didn't want it brought up. I didn't realise Vincent's were relegated.
Oh, yeah, we talked about it ages ago.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah.
I only discovered this when wallowing in the Jude's misery of losing another county final. The confusion around the Dublin Championship is very, very real for me. They're down in intermediate. No, they're in senior two.
Yeah. Which I think is...
Which means they can't win Senior 1.
No, they can't win Senior 1. What's
going on, Jer?
In other counties, it would be effectively intermediate, right? But it's not intermediate because there's like...
And intermediate is below that as well.
There is. Well, there's 6 million divisions. So I think they just had a young team who... Like, it's a... There was... I think there was a run of 2 or 3 games where you win 2 and you're in. But you lose two when you're suddenly in a relegation playoff. Right. And, yeah, I don't know. I think it was Whitehall that beat them as well, so. Oof. Bit of a local rivalry.
Wow.
Good coffee in Whitehall.
Watch.
Amazing coffee in Whitehall.
Championship! Well, already?
No.
Wow.
I would happily buy coffee in Vincent's if you could get some. So, anyway, let's move on. St. Pat's won the Cup yesterday in a brilliant penalty shootout. I think the Cup final kind of disappointed in many respects, and it was nil all after 90 minutes, one all after...
It always is, Ger.
Too tense? Too stressful?
12 finals at the Aviva Stadium. 9 of them have gone to extra time.
Some of them have been crackers, though, right?
Some have been crackers, but, you know, some of them haven't. Maybe it's the fact that suddenly these players who are used to playing in front of 4,000 or 5,000 are in front of, well, you know, the biggest crowd ever in FAI Cup final yesterday, 37,000 at it. The extra time delivered, though, didn't it? I was doing the commentary on the United-Chelsea game, so I was sort of half following it, then watching the highlights last night. Chris Forrester's goal, if that had proven to be the match winner, would have gone down as one of the great FAI Cup final goals. Picks it up inside his own half, weaves his way to the edge of the area, smashes it in, and he's had a real revival this year. Obviously a huge amount of interviews with lots of the players, some really good stuff over the weekend, and you know, he was the boy wonder of Irish football 7-8 years ago. Goes to England, comes back, and you're expecting him to come and dominate the league. Doesn't happen. He's spoken about a huge amount of personal issues that he's had to battle through, and felt as though maybe his career was sort of petering out. Stephen O'Donnell comes in, makes a connection with him, gets him fully focused, gets him playing probably the best football that he's played in 7-8 years, and to go to a cup final then yesterday and to score a goal like that, probably deserved to be the match winner. Obviously Bowes get the equaliser, goes to penalties, Forrester misses his penalty. But Robbie Benson, who was there alongside Stephen O'Donnell for the glory days at Dundalk, is the man who's the hero. And it does feel again that, like, I know it's too easy to say that the club game is in a good place, but there's a real buzz, particularly in Dublin right now, and around the rest of the country, maybe it's a different issue. We saw, obviously, Waterford, the way it's fallen apart, and Waterford been beaten then by UCD in the playoff on Friday night, means there's going to be no clubs from Munster in the League of Ireland Premier Division next year. It's going to be very, very Dublin-centric with UCD in there as well. But, you know, you have Shamrock Rovers as the champions, getting huge crowds to Tala every week. You know, Bowes and Pats have really managed to ingrain themselves in their communities.
Shelburne of Duffer.
So, as a Dublin thing, it's going to be huge. And Derry have a massive investment coming in, have signed a lot of players already. They look like they could be maybe even the strongest contenders to go up against Shamrock Rovers. Dundalk is always going to be fascinating to see what happens, albeit maybe operating off a smaller budget next season and maybe not quite been able to get to where they were over the last few years. But yeah, brilliant for Pats and brilliant for Stephen O'Donnell as well, who I know already has been linked with maybe a move away, that he hasn't committed his future to the club. But, you know, Stephen's been in this studio a lot talking about, you know, his own career, the lessons he learned from going over to Arsenal. Been that, like, Stephen was this wonder kid in the west of Ireland when he was 12, 13, 14 years of age. Would have been himself, probably didn't make the most of the opportunity when he went to Arsenal. Was just that little bit too young, pretty much a fish out of water. But much like Chris Forrester, met the right manager at the right time in Stephen Kenny. Flourished later in his career, and you know, being a League of Ireland manager ain't easy.
No,
like it's
it's week to week. And so the back page of the Daily Mail this morning, an exclusive from Philip Quinn: Steve Staunton could be set for a shock return to management with his hometown club Dundalk. The former Ireland manager, Ireland's first hunter cap international, is understood to have contact with the county outside about the post. Finney Perth returned as manager last June for a second spell until the end of the season, but his future is uncertain. So I had incorrectly assumed that it was just going to roll over and that Finney would be back next season, but it doesn't look like that's guaranteed. And there's a few lines here. So Sportsmail understands Staunton, 52, whose appointment could attract investors, is under consideration for the post. So it looks like he has been in contact with them.
Like, what does attract investors mean? Attract new sponsors or attract somebody to take a chunk of the club? Because obviously the celebration is that it's back in local ownership again. There's also speculation around Stephen O'Donnell. What needs to come out is what Dundalk's ambitions are in terms of, we will, for the next few years, always associate Dundalk with
Dundalk's new owners are eager to re-establish the club as a powerhouse in Irish club football.
Well, then you got to go and
spend the money,
back that up and spend it. And
the Derry money and beat the Rovers money.
When you've consistently over the last couple of years lost your best players to Derry and Shamrock Rovers.
Yeah, now, I'm old enough to remember that there was a bit of an arms race which produced that great Shelburne team but made Shelburne collapse on the back of it because they incurred debts. So you want to make sure that if there's any money being spent, that it is spent in a sustainable way and based on budgets that are not based on qualifying for the group stages of the Champions League, you know?
Yeah, which, you know, for Dundalk ain't going to happen anytime in the near future again. So, what is their aim? Is it to get back very quickly and be contending with Shamrock Rovers? Like, they're miles, miles behind Shamrock Rovers. And again, they're losing Michael Duffy, Pat McElhaney. Like, they're losing their most talented players again. So, I think that's probably the most difficult job in the League of Ireland next year, because the expectation, certainly outside of Dundalk, is going to be, well, you need to be contending because that's what we've done for the last decade. Whereas the reality is the playing squad and the budget is probably going to be miles off that. So if you're Stephen O'Donnell, I know there's the emotional connection with Dundalk and he's seen how it was done before. Maybe it's attractive, but you've just won the league with Pats.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Steve Staunton being...
A cup with Pats.
Oh, Steve Staunton being there would be interesting.
Yeah, suddenly you've got... Jesus, you've got a...
Staunton and Duffer.
Staunton and Duffer, that's a very left-wing League of Ireland. A more left-wing League of Ireland than... It is even right now. It couldn't be much more left wing.
We should talk about the crowd trouble at Irishtown, which obviously did the rounds on Twitter yesterday. The Bowles fans were being fingered with the blame, but it was hard to establish exactly what had happened. And it doesn't seem as if there's been too much coming out from the guards in terms of details of exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think they're investigating. Look, I think everyone saw the pictures and it's pretty horrifying. And it seems as if it was a family event for Pat supporters. I've only seen the video from outside, so I'm not sure, you know, was there kids in there as well? And it does seem out of nowhere, a group of what we're told are Bowles fans, but, you know, wearing, I guess, the typical hooligan gear of just being in all black so they can't be properly identified, come in and just out of nowhere attack all the Pat supporters, which is pretty outrageous in a pretty quiet part of Dublin. This sort of thing doesn't happen around these sort of games, around the Aviva Stadium. But look, there is a history there between Pats and Bowles. There's a history between Bowles and Shamrock Rovers. There's an element that, like all hooliganism, there's a lot of young lads who are just looking for a scrap and attach themselves to the club and destroy the club's reputation. And I see a lot of people jumping on saying, you know, the usual, this wouldn't happen in other sports, yada, yada, yada. Like,
Ireland's a pretty violent society. If you go out and look at any late Friday night in any provincial town, any city, there's scraps. Like, and we can tut-tut and we can say that this is specifically localised to League of Ireland football, but it isn't.
No, but it's important as well that the FAI and the clubs get out in front of this, because
immediately,
there's 37,000 people there yesterday. Yeah. Season tickets are on sale for next year for all the clubs, and you want to get that floating voter, and you don't want people watching the news.
No, is it safe for the families to go to games? You don't know.
And who's this? What? Well, football, hooliganism. This is, you know, actually, you know, I go to Tal every week. I've never seen anything, even the slightest issue at all. Aside from everybody's kids running on when they win the title and destroying the pitch and things like that. But like, this is not a representation of day-to-day League of Ireland life. So I think they need to get out in front of it, make that clear, find the people who were involved.
Yeah, and... Because, like, how are they organising? Maybe they're organising on Telegram. I don't know. Are they even that organised? Were there tweets? Were there Snapchats? Like, surely there is somebody whose job it is to...
Well, there must have been. There had to be, because it clearly looked organised, premeditated, that they knew that this event was happening in the pub. They knew it was going to be full of Pats fans, and they knew they were probably... When would you be ever ready to be randomly attacked on the street?
Brian Dillon says Everton lost yesterday. The narrative straight away from Nathan is that Rafa is under real pressure. I don't support Everton, but it's straight to the blame the manager for everything narrative. Brian Dillon, getting in touch again.
That's not the blame. The manager always gets the blame.
Brian Dillon saying, sorry, I can't stop saying narrative. I blame the media. You blame the media. Nathan blames the manager. That's how it goes.
Well, what is the alternative that we say Everton need to sell 8 of their players to teach them a lesson for getting 5-6 managers sacked? Like, that's just not how football works.
Probably,
the option is always change the manager.
Sai Kaushik says, Ralf Rangnick did not pick the team. Carrick confirmed it, and therefore we must believe it. Everybody always tells the 100% truth in post-match press conferences. That is fact. We know that to be fact. We know no one has ever, ever said something that was, you know, a little bit off.
Rangnick didn't pick the team. And also, Rangnick couldn't be that much of a genius
if then by one phone call with Michael Carrick you can change their entire style of play?
Well, because they've done this before. They did it all last year. When Roy's saying in the aftermath, where was the plan last year? Well, this was the plan last year. We would defend and try and play in the counter-attack. And they didn't.
Yesterday was different because I don't think they tried to play in the counter-attack. Maybe they just weren't good enough to.
Well, they were trying to. I mean, they were trying to, but they were incapable of it. That's different.
Mm.
If United fans weren't happy, Ole starting McFred in central mid, they're definitely not going to be happy if rumoured to be believed that Ralph picked the team yesterday and added Matic to the party, says John Claffey.
I thought Matic was really good yesterday, actually.
But he ain't the future.
No, he's not. But he, again, turns out the three of them just about do the job that maybe Declan Rice could do.
Is Fred an attacking midfielder and they've just been using him badly the whole time?
Well,
isn't that
I don't know if Fred's an attacking midfielder, but there is maybe a potential in Fred that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer couldn't fully realise, or that Jose Mourinho couldn't fully realise, and that, you know, this is what good managers do. They bring them to another level.
He can press, we've seen. He's good at that.
Mm.
Maybe he's your forward. He's the I am deciding where the press is, and everybody.
He's your Gini Wijnaldum.
Maybe. There's a. It's not. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I'm leaving it at that. I'm also leaving open the room that this is a complete failure. Every range of outcome is possible at this point with the Radnik era.
Where do they go next?
I don't know. United out of the red, give it to me, says Patrick Mackin. We gave it to you. We put Ronaldo in the red because we think that the clock is ticking. Henry Winter style, the clock is ticking on Cristiano Ronaldo's time at Manchester United, whether or not it's in the January transfer window or whether or not it's next summer. You think he's going to be here next Christmas 2022, Cristiano Ronaldo, after the World Cup?
Yes.
Coming back to Manchester United?
Coming back. I think he'll still be there by the World Cup. Definitely.
OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. If you want to get involved, if you want your chance to win a Gillette starter pack, all you got to do is tell us who you think should be in the green, which is good, who you think should be in the amber, which is meh, and who you think should be in the red, which is full stop. We're going to take a quick break. Back after these.
OTBAM's performance rankings with Gillette.
Yeah, but look, to be honest with you, the lads are energised by Munster Championship, and that's, we had no opportunity last year to play Munster Championship. So look, 2 years ago we were obviously beaten in the Munster final, and the lads are really, really look forward to Munster Championship games, and they probably played our best hurling in Munster. Like, there was games in Waterford this year where, we barely got over the line in some games. Maybe Waterford hurling is a little bit stronger than people think at club level. A lot of people kind of think talk down on Waterford hurling and Waterford club hurling, saying that it's not at a level because we've won 8 championships in a row. But I can tell you one thing. Every year we've won those 8 championships, we've improved. And we'll try and improve again next year, because we don't want to be beaten in Waterford. And that's, I stand over, the strength of Waterford Club Hurling, even though some people from the outside mightn't agree with me,
Can you talk to us a little bit about the four Mahoney boys? Obviously, Pádraig was brilliant on the freeze. Philip, how important was that to get 50 minutes into him today?
Actually, listen, Philip has had 2 leg breaks this year. To come back from the injuries he's had. You look at Pádraig coming back from a crucial injury. You look at Kevin today, who was exceptionally youngest of them. I think Mikey got man of the match. They're all phenomenal guys, But there's loads of them in that dressing room, You've likes of Barry Coughlin, giant captain fullback, and other outstanding guys. Saki, Shane, there's loads of them there, I better stop mentioning them now, or people will be glad you didn't mention me. But listen, look, Look, we're lucky. We're lucky to have leaders in the dressing room. We're lucky to have leaders in the club. And, those guys are mainly one of the main group of people that are driving this thing on,
You mentioned the early start this morning and the long trip up, and I suppose you're used to having those journeys. You've been blessed over the last couple of years that you've been able to do that. It must be incredibly enjoyable to be a part of this group. It looks out there like it's a real team that are together.
Yeah, it's a very close-knit bond between the group, and that has been built up over a long number of years. And days like this are the best days, And I said it the other night when I was talking to the lads about, going on the bus trip today. And I said, when you retire out of hurling, you'll remember the days we went to Sixmile Beach 2 years ago and we got a result in Sixmile Beach. We're going to Ennis this Sunday. We'll get a result in Ennis. And that's the reality. They're the best days that you remember as a player. And look, I'm privileged, to be honest with you, to be, involved with a group like these guys, And, it's about driving on now and seeing if we get prepare ourselves now for the semi-final,
Right, that was the Ballygunner manager Darragh Sullivan in conversation with Tommy Rooney after their 3-20-2-6 win against Ballyhea in Ennis. They play Lochmore Castellani in 2 weeks' time in the Munster Club semi-final, and that one should be an absolute cracker. Ballygunner, very impressive. That was their first game in 53 days. Some amazing achievement for Lochmore Castellani to win a county double with such a relatively small squad, says Dahi O'Shaughnessy. on YouTube. It is absolutely astonishing, and their pictures are all over the papers as well. This morning, we'll just run you quickly through the papers. Ronaldo out in the cold, says the Daily Telegraph. Do I have any of the other English ones? Oh, Emma Raducanu is back on the back of the London Times. She won for Britain.
Well, it was her first time back in Britain since winning the US Open. So it was the first time she played since becoming a superstar.
Ronaldo acts my decision, says Carrick. So, yeah. Wind of Change. Winds of Change, the German rockers, that song. You know the song?
Yeah.
Yeah. Give us a blast.
I can't whistle very well, so I can't go to... But there is whistling at the start, isn't there?
There is something about Moscow, isn't it? There's a good podcast about it, actually, where there was a suggestion that somehow it had been a CIA creation to help bring down the Iron Curtain. And so this guy tracked down the lead singer, who was like, no, totally not. I've kind of spoiled the eight parts of it there by...
Scorpions.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah. Follow to Moscow. Down to Gorky Park, listening to the Wind of Change.
Yeah, that's it. Good, go on.
No.
Wind of Change. Chelsea charge halted after Ronaldo benched. So we kind of needed Chelsea to drop points.
Yeah, it's very early, but yes. You can feel there's a pressure already on Liverpool and Manchester City with the way that Chelsea have started.
I want a three-way title race. A proper one where they all drop points here and there, and it's not... Because all three of them have squads that are good enough to just go on a run where you reel off 15 wins.
Well, it's incredibly rare that you get that sort of a title race. 2014, the last time, where the Brendan Rodgers Liverpool side, where you had Liverpool, Chelsea and Manchester City, though Chelsea were never maybe fully in it. They were close, but yeah, you would love to see that actually every weekend, the tension that would be there every weekend, March, April, if the three of them were just separated by a couple of points.
Yeah, and that's when you get kind of weird results where good teams start losing to bad teams. So anyway, look, we'll come back to that a little bit later on. I'm delighted to say Andy Mitten is with us this morning. Andy, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay, thank you.
Very interesting team selection yesterday. Very interesting decisions made by Michael Carrick around who he thought should take the field to try and win the game. What kind of a job did Michael Carrick do yesterday, do you think? And what's your take on the dropping of Cristiano?
I thought Michael Carrick had a good week in difficult circumstances. If you'd have said to me last Monday morning, Manchester United would beat Villarreal away 2-0 and hold the European champions away, having taken the league, I would have accepted that. I think most Manchester United fans would have as well. It's been really bad, and that led to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer losing his job. So when I saw the lineup yesterday, I wasn't stunned at Tottenham a few weeks ago either when United changed the formation for that. And the thinking behind it was that United needed all of their players to work incredibly hard for every minute they were on the pitch, and that Cristiano Ronaldo, well, he came on. He didn't even work hard for 30 minutes, let alone the full 90 had he would have started and finished, because he lost... Christian Pulisic, I think it was, who put a cross in for that chance for Chelsea right at the end. So I can understand the reasons, and I think we might see more of it. From my understanding, Ronaldo was never brought to play every single week. Same with Edinson Cavani. Now with Cavani, I won't mind seeing him play once in a while, because his season is similar to the start of last season where he's barely featuring and he finished it really strong. So that's a shame, but I thought Carrick got it pretty spot on at Chelsea, and they're really in form. I'd asked Michael Carrick on Friday about the way Chelsea play, and he spoke in more detail than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would have done about an opponent, which I quite enjoyed listening to a manager talking tactically. And United nearly nicked it. They went ahead. It's really weird to see Manchester United so deep, so defensive, but needs must at the moment. This is a team that's been conceding fours and fives, and I think United getting a result there is not a bad result at all. I was still annoyed though when Chelsea equalised, so I don't think I'll ever be happy not seeing Manchester United not win.
Jesus, fairly damning on Solskjaer, isn't it, that United going to Chelsea with absolutely zero ambition, such a negative lineup, is sort of seen as a success for Michael Carrick, because
they had to set up not to be beaten 4-5-0. Like, that's how far United had fallen over the last few weeks.
Well, both games were 0-0 last season. So you could argue exactly the same thing happened last season under Solskjaer. But I take the point. Look at the league table. Look where Manchester United are. They've clearly been massively underperforming this season. So what was the option? Try and attack them and get another hammer in while the confidence is still fragile, or go for the side which plays so deep. I tweeted that the Manchester United players are so deep, if they go any further back, they're going to be in the River Thames behind the shed end. And it felt like that at times, but it worked. It's a 1-1 draw, and United have got to start picking up the pieces from somewhere. I thought the result in Villarreal was really good. If you'd have said to me at half-time in the Villarreal game at Old Trafford in September that Manchester United will be coming out of this Champions League group with a game to spare, I would have found that a stretch. But that's what happened. And these players have come through a rough time. A lot of the problems are on them as well. Yes, the manager should take some of the criticism, and it's cost him his job. But a lot of them players have been massively underperforming too.
What are you hearing about the Ralf Rangnick signing and his involvement into the future beyond the next few months? Is this a significant sea change in terms of how they want the whole club to be run? What's the point of that?
I'm hearing that of the five people who were interviewed, he was the most impressive one, and Rudy Garcia was the second most impressive one. Garcia came back for a second interview on Wednesday morning. That was the day that the story broke about Ralf Rangnick. I've heard of him, I'd read about him, I'd seen his teams, but when something like that happens, I speak to people who know far more than I do. And I know professional footballers in Germany, former professionals, agents, and they all came back with pretty glowing reports about him, although they did say he's totally intense, he'll demand full control. And that leads into your question about how much control he'll get at Manchester United, which is this big corporation with a global reach. And he has worked for corporations before. He worked at RB, which is even more corporate than Manchester United. He's 63. If he comes in as interim manager, as everybody expects, then he'll choose the teams that he thinks will win football matches. You saw the words from people like Thomas Tuchel, Jurgen Klopp, his compatriots before the game at the weekend. They spoke really glowingly, almost in awe of them. United fans just want to see the team fighting and playing well again, because this season started with high expectations and then imploded. And look at the recent league run of matches. I think Manchester United have won 1 in 6, 1 in 7. That was that game at Tottenham. So Rangnick, it does seem odd, because one of the people I spoke to said he's a builder. He takes time to build projects. And how much of a project can he build in 6 months? But maybe it will be the case that he steadies the ship, if you like, and then he retains a significant influence as Manchester United continue to build onwards and hopefully upwards in the eyes of the fans. I think fans have welcomed the news about him. Certainly those who knew about him, others have been reading up about him. And United fans have been pretty desperate, because it's been that bad. In some cases, it's like, we need someone who's better at his job than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. That said, the fans have continued to sing about Ole Gunnar in Villarreal at Stamford Bridge. And I spoke to him when I was in Villarreal, and I know he really appreciated that support from the fans.
So, Andy, do you think then that Rangnick's appointment is a standalone appointment, that he's there to get the best out of this Manchester United team until the end of the season? Or is it a sort of seismic shift in how United are going to operate, that he will have a role, whether it's as manager or as something else, over the next 2 or 3 years that will dictate who the next manager is, the style of football, what they want to be as a football club as opposed to a business? Do you see this as something that's going to have a long-lasting consequence for how United go about things?
The club would always argue that they're a football club over a business, and people might see it differently because United are so commercially successful, and sometimes it does look overly commercial. But in terms of football decisions and who's picking the team, it's always been the managers who've been there. So if he comes in purely as a manager, I'd expect him to pick the team, make the tweaks. You can see the changes that a manager mid-season can make. The best example of that, the one that a lot of fans almost cling on to is what Tuchel did at Chelsea when he came in midway through last season. My understanding on Ranić was that, and someone said to me the day before it broke, we've got to get a game. It's a no-brainer. And he's extremely experienced and he'll come, but he wants assurances that he'll stay on after the end of this season. So that would lead me to think that there's some kind of role upstairs. Maybe that is a sporting director role. Maybe he does bring in the coach, the person he anoints. Maybe he comes in and sees that Michael Carrick is incredibly fantastic coach in his eyes and thinks, this is the future. I don't think any of that has been decided yet. I don't think Manchester United have decided or got any agreement to bring in Ten Hag from Ajax or Mauricio Pochettino from Spurs. And this whole situation was thrown onto United by a rapid decline in results in the last 2 months. Up until Watford last week, Manchester United wanted it to work out with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It didn't work out. He lost his job. He gets that. That's football. But the exact details of what Ranić's going to do will be made clearer. I still don't think it's been fully sorted out.
You can see any of those outcomes being possible, right? Where Ranić comes in and does really well and actually they give him the job. You can see where he comes in and does well enough where he's given the opportunity to pick somebody and then the transfer policy changes to be more akin to what it has been at the various places that he's worked, and they sign those high energy young players and they sign a load of them and the business model goes away from signing the Galacticos. What is the implication for Ronaldo's long term or medium term future at Manchester United, do you think, either way, with the arrival of Ranić?
Well, going off what you've just said, and you're quite right, he's tended to sign very energetic young emerging players. Maybe he's had to sign that because his team were not the most dominant in the transfer market where he was working in Germany. At Manchester United, he's got a different type of player there. He has got some of them, well, you called them Galacticos, but world-class players. I always remember Carlos Queiroz telling me that when he first arrived at the club, Ferguson said to him, "You take training this morning." And he felt like he'd been handed the keys to a Ferrari because he had all these incredibly top-level players there. And there are still top-level players there. I know pros who've been in at Manchester United this season and they've trained with them or they might have gone out on loan and they say that the levels in training are really high. Now, you might laugh at that because the results have been so poor. But Ranić's got to come in and the first thing he's got to do is stop the team conceding goals, get the team winning again. He'll absolutely be expected to reach the Champions League next season. That's if United are not going to win it this season, which at the moment seems fanciful. And if he's winning, you know what fans are like? If he wins 10 games on the trot, people will be singing Ralph whatever and saying that let's keep with this guy, he's fantastic. And I'm sure he'll get carried away with all of that as well if that was to happen. And if he does so-so, talk will move towards who's going to replace him for next season. He's got to get the results. It's on him, first of all, to get results. He can't come in talking about philosophies and not be winning matches. People will only listen to him if he's winning matches. And of course, people will pay attention to the style in which Manchester United play. It was very defensive at Chelsea, but again, it's Manchester United with all these great attacking players. You can't set up defensively against Norwich at Old Trafford or even Arsenal on Thursday or Crystal Palace on Sunday. He's got a run of games now coming at Old Trafford. So I'm really interested to see tactically what's going to happen when he comes in, as he's expected to come in, how he uses his other coaches. But what he's got to do more than anything is get results. There's a big run of games coming up. You've got all the midweek Premier League games, which we've not been having, and steady the ship and look like it's pointing in a more forward direction to what it has been doing.
Will Ronaldo need managing if he's not in the team every week? Because the debate is obviously ongoing, and Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher went on it yesterday of, you know, he scores goals, but, you know, even in that half an hour yesterday, United looked probably a lesser team with Ronaldo on the pitch than off the pitch. If he isn't playing every week, do you see that becoming a big situation that Ranić is going to have to dedicate a lot of time to keeping Ronaldo, and not just Ronaldo and his people, happy?
Managers make the decisions that are right for the team and for the club. End of. No one player is bigger than the club. Ronaldo has scored some brilliant goals. I think he's still absolutely got something to offer, and he's not getting any younger. I think yesterday was the right decision, because I'm saying that now because United have got a decent result there. But as you said, when he came on, United actually looked inferior. And as I said earlier on, he lost Pulisic, which could have settled the winner for Chelsea towards the end. So there'll be some interesting conversations there, definitely. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether Ralph's going to come in and put his arm around him and say, we're going to build this team around you, or you absolutely do not fit into my style whatsoever and you can go in January. I just don't know, because I'm not making that decision. What I do know is that when he came in August, it was a big surprise for everybody at the club. His signing was landed right on the club. Now, commercially, it was a big success. I don't know many United fans who didn't celebrate him coming back to Old Trafford either. And that atmosphere around those first games, that Newcastle game when he came back, it was incredible. And that's what football can sometimes do, but that bubble is long gone. Now, from Ronaldo's perspective, his stats are still good. He's still getting winners. He's still scoring great goals. Great goal at Tottenham. Key goal in Atalanta. Winners against Villarreal against Atalanta. So I think he's still got something. And that's for a smarter footballing mind than mine to work out how Manchester United use him. I just don't know the question. Clearly he's got a big ego. Clearly he's influential in the dressing room. Before the Watford game, he was the one who tried to get the players together and say, this hasn't been good enough, we've got to be, got to give more, etc., etc. I've not heard any examples of him putting, throwing a big sulk in, but then again, he's not used to being a substitute either. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Cristiano Ronaldo.
The makeup of the squad is actually quite good if you were to take Ronaldo out, in terms of particularly the front players. They are young and energetic. There's definitely an issue around Rashford's form at the moment. How well is Rashford playing? How much better does he need to play to be a regular contributor at this level for Manchester United at the moment?
Don't think he did anything in the first half yesterday, but you could say that of a lot of players up front, because they weren't getting much of the ball. I thought he did well after the first half. Start of the second half, I thought he looked pretty impressive. He's got to improve. He's had a real up and down year, laced with injury, but we've not been seeing the Marcus Rashford that he wants to see himself, and he's got to improve. With Jadon Sancho, who's another young attacker, he had a good week. He got his first goal and a great goal in Villarreal. He scored again at Stamford Bridge, so baby steps for him, but definitely encouraging. With Anthony Martial, he's nowhere at the moment. He'd started under Michael Carrick, and he's really struggled. A lot of United fans have not got much faith in Anthony Martial. And then you've got the other more mature attackers, Cavani, Ronaldo. So, yes, Rashford needs to raise his game, but I could say that of 80% of the players. I could say even more of Bruno Fernandes, whose form has really dropped off. And he was pointing to the away fans at Watford last week, saying, don't blame him, i.e. the manager, blame us. Yeah, we certainly will. Now, with Bruno, he was dropped.
He's got to be careful with that, isn't he? Like, do you know, it's great. It's great fronting up now, but like maybe front up on the field.
Well, you're right, because he's been poor. And he was dropped in Villarreal, and he deserved to be dropped. But when he came on, he did really well. And Marcus Rashford did well too. So, got all these little ups and downs. What United need is more consistency from all of those players. Fergie always said it's, you know, you need 8 out of your 11 playing to win, be winning matches. At times this season, it's been 2 or 3 with Manchester United. And Bruno's baffling because he was so good. He was that rocket fuel when he arrived in January 2020, and he was seen as being Manchester United's best player by a distance. And that hasn't been the case in the last couple of months. And you'd look for somebody like him to help get Manchester United out of this slump. He makes those wonderful passes. Yes, he loses the ball because he takes more risks than other players, but Bruno is one of several players who needs to get his form back.
and I guess so much focus is going to be on Ronaldo and what he does with Ronaldo. Actually, maybe Fernandez is the key for Rangnick over the next few months, because he has carried a club on his shoulders before. When he was at Sporting Lisbon, there was probably no team in Europe that was as much as a one-man team as they were with Bruno Fernandez. And as you say, maybe he was the best player in the Premier League for the first year when he came in. Something seems to have gone wrong, though. Like, his attitude, as much as anything else, like the throwing the arms around, the constantly at referees. I know yesterday, I think, was his fourth booking already, so he's on the verge of, you know, getting a suspension for that. That mentally, whatever about his actual all-round game, just something seems off with Bruno Fernandez that Rangnick's going to have to fix pretty quickly.
Yeah, and he actually lifted Manchester United. It wasn't just the Sporting Club. When he came to Old Trafford, the team without him were 30% inferior. I noticed at Wolves away at the start of this year that he was being particularly petulant. I think I tweeted during the game, he needs to keep his mouth shut, because I started noticing what has now become a trait to his game, the whinging, and I don't like to see it. I don't know why he's doing it. I don't think it helps his game. Maybe it's frustration because things aren't coming off, because he's not playing as well as he did do, because he's not been as effective as he was. But he needs to get back to where he was, or try to. And again, it's down to a smarter football brain than my one, an experienced football brain, who's going to come in and see which players he wants to fit into his system. And I'm sure he's got his opinions on all of those Manchester United players.
It's a really interesting period, right? This transfer window, because already they're talking about Rangnick's going to come in and there's going to be a clear out of players, and we haven't even mentioned Pogba. So you're the owners, and or Ed Woodward or whoever, if it's going to be Richard Arnold, the new chief executive, making these decisions, and you're giving this guy 6 months, but this transfer window is going to be hugely important, and he might come in and do something, and your new manager might be like, geez, I really wish I had all those players you let go. So it feels like the transfer window will show us how committed they are to his ideology into the future. And if they've decided that his ideology is going to be the defining ideology over the next 2.5-3 seasons, and it will be a project, then he gets rid of Pogba and he gets rid of Ronaldo and maybe he gets rid of Bruno in this transfer window. And you're like, OK, we see exactly the type of player that he wants, and brings in some younger players or some players who will be more akin to his style of play. Like, that's all up for grabs, isn't it?
Well, I've not heard anywhere that the manager's going to come in and get rid of loads of players. What I have heard is that other coaches saying this Manchester United team should be doing far better with their existing players, and that tactically they're not being as smart as they could be. I'd be stunned if Ralph Rangnick came in and got rid of 6 players in January and brought 6 players in. Stranger things have happened. But I think from Manchester United's perspective, they've spent a fortune on players. There's actually a very good squad there. Someone's got to get them playing again. And I won't be surprised if there were no transfers in January. You mentioned Paul Pogba, but that's on Pogba. That's not on the club. Pogba's been offered a new contract and he's decided not to sign that new contract, which is his right. Fans don't like it, but then a lot of fans have been wholly unconvinced by Paul Pogba as well. And his performances on the pitch have completely underwhelmed since he arrived from Turin in 2016. So again, it's on the manager. He's got to work out this puzzle. He might come in and say, you know what, Pogba, he ain't going to play again. Ronaldo is not going to play again. Or he might put Ronaldo in net because he thinks that's the right way forward. Whoever it is and whatever he does, he's got to get Manchester United winning again. Wins blow the clouds away. Performances come second to that. But look at that league table at the moment. And it is absurd that a team who spent so much money with all of those wonderful players are, what, 8th in the league? I've not even dared look at the league table this morning. 8th.
It's not great. 8th. Come here. Last one for you then. It's like you keep saying, you've referenced it a couple of times, we expect that it will be Rangnick. Is there any room for doubt at this stage, or is that just the official announcement? We don't know when it's expected. There hasn't been an announcement of a press conference imminent or any of that kind of stuff just yet. What's the delay?
I've not heard of any announcement yet. The last thing I heard was he was respectful to Lokomotiv Moscow, as were Manchester United. As I said, United were still interviewing managers up until last Wednesday when the news broke. I also said Ranić was the most impressive candidate, followed by Rudy Garcia, who was asked to come back to Old Trafford for a second interview. I've not been told anything to say that Ranić is not happening, nor have been told that there's a press conference at 4 o'clock today. I could end this call now and look at my emails and there might be that announcement and I wouldn't be stunned. I would expect that to be the case and for Ralf Ranić to come in. I just don't know when that is going to happen.
Okay. All right. Good stuff, Andy. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Thank you.
It's Andy Mitten there from United We Stand. You can read the stuff in The Athletic and, of course, in ESPN as well. It's an interesting period. Like, they if they're signing Ranić, you have to give him some kind of immediate autonomy to say, well, your squad is completely imbalanced. Mm. Like, you list off the attacking players. Part of me thought they were picking Martial recently to try and get some transfer value back. It's like, oh, he can still play football at this level.
It's a risky game by Solskjaer when you're just about to be sacked.
It didn't work. It definitely didn't work for either in either way. But he looked like his touch was off. But
I just think the details about what happens with Ranić are going to be what's most interesting because, listening to Andy there, it doesn't seem anything set in stone as to what happens next and what his influence in the short and medium term is going to be at Manchester United, because it does feel as though that if he comes in and is the most influential footballing brain at the club for the next 4 or 5 years, like, that's a huge shift in what Manchester United have been about. But if this is just bringing him in for 6-7 months and, well, we're going from Maurizio Pochettino unless, but then Paris Saint-Germain win the Champions League and he's a hero in Paris and they offer him twice as much money and he says, actually, I'm going to stay, and well maybe Ralf stays, or as you said, if he's a massive success and he doesn't want to leave the job himself.
Yeah.
It can all get quite messy, and at Manchester United it tends to get quite messy.
That's a bit Father Ted, where the people who are holding the raffle sometimes win the raffle, where Ranić decides, I'm the man for this
who's,
job.
Who's the who could do this? Well, I've looked around. Maurizio just does. It's a certain things Maurizio doesn't have that I myself actually
I looked into my soul out and decided this is what the people of Manchester need.
It's hard to see in the situation how they would give Ranić, you know, 100 million to spend in January, and also, you know, who are you getting? Maybe you bring in one or two players and you let a couple of players out on loan to try and send them on the way.
Yeah, or you just decide this is our guy and he's looking at it and going, so maybe he can turn Martial into something, you know, like maybe with a bit of coaching. Like, if you're Martial, you've got there and there's been nobody who's really believed in you at any point, and you've never had, it looks like from the outside, brilliant coaching. Oh, Solskjaer is going to be really good for all the forwards of the club, isn't he? No, that was not the case. Ronaldo, everybody's going to really learn from him. So far, nobody's performance of the forward players has been better since Ronaldo arrived, has it? Oh, it's like a PhD in finishing. It's like, no, it's not. It really isn't. It's like a PhD in being pissed off that this guy's getting all the chances. And everybody always looks for him on the field because they know that they're going to get slaughtered if they don't give it to him.
Look, if he turns Anthony Martial around, give him whatever the hell he wants. We're talking miracle territory.
Is it miracle territory for a 25-year-old suddenly?
But maybe he just gets rid. Good. Everyone is comparing everything already with Tuchel and Klopp, and they've gone about it in different ways because Tuchel obviously made an instant impression and wins the Champions League a couple of years.
Klopp
took Klopp quite a while.
Yeah.
But
everybody
also
got injured. Remember the extra training sessions? Everybody was injured.
But he also took no nonsense and got rid of players that didn't fit in with what he wanted pretty quickly. The likes of Mahamudu Sakho, who was, you know, seen maybe not as the best influence around the training ground. Daniel Sturridge was got rid of. Joe Allen. Players like this that didn't fit in with the way he wanted to play were just pushed aside. So
yeah,
that may be what needs to happen at United as well, bit by bit.
All right. It's 8:49 this morning here. You're watching OTBAM. With Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. And so we've already done the back pages for you, as we'll get to rugby. Alan Quinlan is with us this morning. Alan, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, lads. How are you?
That Munster situation that they find themselves in at the moment is pretty tricky. Are you hearing anything from anybody on the ground?
No, not really. I was as shocked as everybody else that it's a disaster, really, for them, isn't it? Pretty difficult that they, you know, they should have been playing a match at the weekend and playing next weekend, and now they find themselves kind of stuck there and possibly facing a quarantine period when they come home. So it really makes it very, very difficult for them. And I suppose with the other Cardiff Blues have a similar situation. They have two positive cases in their camp, so they're stranded in South Africa as well. Zebra and the Scarlets got on a flight yesterday, and they're probably home at this stage. So it's a really tricky situation for them, and one that I'm sure concerns them a lot.
Well, Nathan's pointing out as well, it's going to have more than likely a knock-on impact for the Champions Cup as well.
Yeah, well, it just depends now at this stage. What happens if they can get out in the next day or two? Maybe they can do the 10-day isolation and go to Wasps and play the match. Obviously, in a situation that's going to be really tricky with if they have to do quarantine periods. You know, I was thinking about this. Do they do it somewhere where they can actually train together and stay in a bubble and actually prepare for the match? Or do they all go home or stay in, you know, or do they stay in a hotel somewhere where they have no training facilities and they can't get outside the door? If they could get back and train as a group, maybe they can go and play that match. But they've got to get back in the next day or two, really. And if that positive case is, do they leave that person behind? I don't know what happens. It's absolutely crazy, because if they have to go into quarantine for 10 days and it's later in the week, well, you know, they play, is it Sunday week that game is, or Sunday 2 weeks? It just makes it really, really difficult for them. It's Sunday week. So it's a really crazy situation. Maybe that game will get postponed against Wasps and they play it another time. I don't know. They'll need help from URC. But look, they're in a situation that's probably out of their control now at the moment. And Cardiff are the same. They play Toulouse at home on the Saturday week. They're in a similar situation.
Yeah, it's such a shame, because we were really looking forward to actually seeing the matches where the Irish teams went up against the best of the South African teams. We've obviously seen the weaker South African teams over the last couple of years in the league, but this was the first opportunity that we had to see what looked like a full-strength Munster team up against a full-strength South African side and kind of really test ourselves against their best. So we'll obviously keep a close eye on that story, and we'll update everybody on otbsports.com as it evolves and as we get more information from Munster. But let's talk about the actual rugby that was played on the field. Pardon me, Ulster beat Leinster. And I know that the game ends on an intercept, but Ulster were full value for this win, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. I think the way they started the game, they were full of intent, and you just got the feeling that there was a real fear about their performance, and that that fear of not being able to beat Leinster and deal with them. They've come close a couple of times, I think, but there was a couple of big wins in the last number of years. They haven't won there in 8 years. They're coming on the back of Connacht destroyed them in Dublin the last time they played. I was surprised. I think lots of people were surprised, and maybe Leinster just thought they were going to turn up, which we don't really associate that with Leinster. They're usually very, very ruthless, but Ulster were full value for that win, I think. Their breakdown, their defence, their work rate was through the roof, and they deserved that win. I think when Robbie Henshaw scores a try and then they level the match with a penalty, you're thinking the inevitable is going to happen here. But to be fair to Ulster, that was a real... a real big step for them as a group. I think to be that mentally tough and to keep going and to react. And, you know, it was the 78th minute he gets the intercept try, James Hume. So it wasn't as if it was, the 10 or 15 minutes and they stretched out to 10 points again. I think their performance was brilliant. Can they back it up now? We've seen some performances from Ulster like that in the last number of years, but they've been very inconsistent at times. Leo Cullen was very frustrated, I think, but very honest in his appraisal after the game that it wasn't good enough from Leinster. And it's a big moment. If Ulster can capitalise on this and build on this, they have to go to Clermont in Europe and then home to Northampton. So they've a real big couple of weeks. They're away at the Ospreys next weekend. So can they build on this? That's the question.
It's rare to see and hear Leo Cullen, as peeved as he was after the game, talking about there'd been a lot of hype
around this team and a sense that maybe they were a little bit complacent. We saw this group go to Dragons and maybe one of Leinster's worst performances in years earlier in the season, that we all just expect this Leinster conveyor belt to complete delivering performances, and maybe that somehow seeped into the squad as well.
It's possible, Nathan, and it can happen. Everybody can kind of have one of those off days. As I said, you don't really see it that much from Leinster. They've scored the most, conceded the least in the league up to this point. They've been very, bar that Dragons match, as you said, where it was a poor performance. And maybe it's a mental thing. And he did say that. I thought it was really interesting that maybe some of the players believed the hype. Very, very strong Leinster side. I was surprised with the likes of Tadhg Furlong starting the game. But look, there's obviously a plan for this next block, and they manage the players like that. And I'm sure Furlong wanted to start, and they probably needed him to start because Alatoa was away with Samoa. But yeah, mentally, it looked like they left it too late to react. But then they had periods in the game where they looked like they'd score, and they looked like the inevitable would happen. But credit to Ulster, Timoney, Alan O'Connor, these guys, they just put in so many tackles. James Humes was brilliant in the centre. And like I said, it can be bad mentally. And mentally, we're talking about Leinster maybe switching off a little bit here. And sometimes you can change that out on the field over the 80 minutes. But when you lose the match, you can look back at the maybe things that happen in training and maybe just being a little bit relaxed going into the game, even if it's only a couple of percent. But the real key here is Ulster for them. Can they build on this and get consistency and have that kind of steely edge about them? We've questioned their kind of their tenacity and their aggression for a long number of years now. And chalk and cheese, the performance, wasn't it? Connacht destroyed them a few weeks ago, and we're full value for that. And that was a strong Leinster side. I know they're missing a few, and they have the depth to make a lot of changes. It was a strong Leinster side.
It was. While there are some players who are missing, it's still a side that in the past would have played in a Champions Cup game, and you would have been like, oh, that's their first choice scrum half, and that, so Sexton's injured, so okay, Ross Byrne is playing, but he's playing well for Ireland. Around 18 months ago, that team that took the field wouldn't have been a million miles away from a starting side, and they just weren't at the pitch against Ulster. You mentioned Hume. I want to go back to him because one of the papers is talking about he's one of the players who was disappointed not to get game time, and who Andy Farrell would have told, you need to go make sure that it's not even up for debate whether or not you're getting picked. Is he that close to playing for Ireland at this stage? Is he that good?
He has serious talent. I think he's one of the players that, if you're going to go on and play for Ireland, you've got to step up in the big games consistently. He's still learning, but I think he has the talent. I thought it was an opportunity lost not trying to get him game time, because I believe he has the ability to step up. He has the talent anyway, to step up to that level and play for Ireland.
And what are his skill sets? So tell us.
He's an incredibly balanced runner. I think he's an intelligent footballer as well, and just a real natural kind of runner with the ball. Does he need to be more aggressive and defensively? Yes. You look at Henshaw, what makes Henshaw so good is, even without the ball, just the aggression, the ability to get turnovers, impact tackles. At the top level, for James Hume, I think he needs to be more aggressive, stronger, with the ball, without the ball. So I think the natural skills is something that he's brilliant at. It's the other parts of his game that take you to the next level. And that takes a little bit of time. He's a silky kind of a footballer. He can step outside you. He can run hard. He's a lot of pace.
Is he depth for Gary Ringrose then? Is that what we're...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he is. And, you look at Ringrose, the way he's developed into a really physical player now. Gary Ringrose, when he came on the scene first, was this silky runner who was a little bit light, maybe. You look at Gary Ringrose now, he's still only 26, but he's a physical specimen. He's after getting a lot stronger. He's really aggressive in the tackle. He's hard when he has to carry into traffic, stuff like that. They're small little things that hopefully will come to James Hume. But look, it's early days for him. And I'm not saying that he should have been playing for Ireland, but I think he's someone that has the ability to play for Ireland, and he has a natural ability. So hopefully he can perform well for Ulster now and get that opportunity again going forward. But just develop his game more and have a real presence on the field in the big games.
While we've all obviously been sort of salivating over the international team's performances in the November internationals, that probably wasn't the case around the provinces. And I wonder how much Ulster and maybe all the provinces have a bit of a chip on their shoulder with the Leinster representation and needing to prove a point, because Dan McFarlane made a funny enough comment earlier in the week when he was asked, how do you beat Leinster? And he said, don't ask the All Blacks, which is a great line. And James Hume was talking about the Irish situation and how he's looking at this now as a 9-week block ahead of the Six Nations, that maybe there was a bit of shock among some of the players outside of Leinster that they didn't get the opportunities they thought they might get, and they need to use that and harness that now over the Christmas.
Yeah, but look, none of them can have any complaints, Nathan. The Leinster players that played for Ireland throughout the block were outstanding, and let's not kid ourselves here for any Leinster people watching it. You know, you've Porter, Doris, Sexton, Ringrose, Kelleher, they're top class internationals that are missing for, you know, Hugo Keenan wasn't there. So there's
James Lowe.
There's six James Lowe. There's seven or eight
Van der Fleer
internationals, Doris, there, you know. That, yeah. You just keep going, don't you?
The
you just keep
back
going.
Row.
Yeah, but look, you put those guys, they're at a different level at the moment. But Gerard said it, you know, these are the games that Leinster were able to win over the years. So, you know, it was probably close enough to a full strength side. I think, you know, Henderson is missing obviously for Ulster, and they've one or two others, Stockdale. But Leinster can do that, and they've done it over the years. None of the provinces can have any complaints about the Leinster players that played for Ireland, because, as I said, they were outstanding. And maybe he's given them that little bit of chip that, you know, but look, Leinster have been a dominant side for years, so anytime anyone plays them now, they have to cope with that intensity and that relentlessness from the opposition.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Leo Cullen referred to it as a kick up the ass, and it'll be interesting to see exactly how many of those players he goes back to in the big moments over the next couple of weeks, in particular when those big games are coming thick and fast. Let's talk about Connacht, because the Connacht season has been a bit stop-start at the very start, and even within games they were brilliant for 15-20 minutes, but they couldn't put the performances together consistently, and then week on week off there was a real concern that they were going to be able to do it. And in the build up to this game, reading Andy Friend talking about it, he was talking about the quality of the opposition, and so I think he was putting his team on notice, and he was putting everybody else on notice that, like, if we aren't at it, then we're going to go back to the lack of consistency that has been there all season. And it was the opposite. They put in their best performance of the season, building on a performance against Ulster the previous week in unbelievably shitty conditions, which, if you're a Connacht fan, must make you very excited. Like, what they did on Friday was sensational.
It's the way they play, isn't it? And I think that ambition to keep the ball alive, to put the ball through hands, their lines are running, their shape is really good. They've won three, lost three, so it's not the best return for them. A couple of brilliant performances, and that Ulster one was the last time. And this one was very impressive. Because of the conditions, the weather was horrendous on Friday night. The Ospreys aren't the strongest side, let's be honest about it. But they were ruthless, and the tries they scored and the dominance they showed was sensational. I think Mac Hansen has been a great signing for him. Brilliant footballer, has a real eye for scoring tries, and Shane Bolton got a really good try as well. So they've a lot of natural footballers, and Andy Friend has recruited pretty well with those guys. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of impact and how often Shane Bolton will play. Will he end up playing a 10 some matches? He was 13 the other night, and he was really good. But the fullback, Aaron McNulty, I tell you, he got a brilliant try, and overall his performance, he just looked electric. He looked electric at fullback, pace, looking for the gap the whole time, Just a natural kind of wanting to run with the ball. I thought he was really impressive as well. So it was a brilliant performance for them. And that's the way they can play. If you allow Connacht to play, you know, the old tag of stuff it up the jumper is gone 10 years ago. You know, this is the way Connacht play now. This is the way they want to play. They want to keep the ball alive. Conor Oliver was brilliant. Paul Boyle, just constantly guys looking for the ball, and they have a brilliant work rate. So I just think the execution in those conditions the other night was really, really impressive.
A couple of things, right? So I'm just checking McNulty's birthday there. Born in January 2000. So he's only 21. That's pretty exciting if you're a Connacht fan. And then a couple of the other ones you're talking about as well. So Shane Bolton. How far away is Bolton from playing for Ireland? How far away is Mac Hansen from being something that, like Andy Friend obviously brought him into the, Andy Farrell obviously brought him into the squad to have a look, and that might have just been a curiosity, like let's see what this guy has for a couple of training sessions, and maybe he was never near getting game time, but all of a sudden there's players there that the Ireland selectors are going to watch and going, how will they fit into our setup? Well, they're playing our style of rugby and they're very comfortable in it, so we can get them in and see how it goes.
They're just good footballers, Ger. And I think that's, if you can get natural footballers into your team, obviously their backs, I don't know where Shane Bolden sits, but obviously with the RFU and with Connacht, they've identified a guy who can potentially go and play for Ireland here. He's still very young as well. He's Irish qualified. Mac Hansen the same. Aaron McNulty was born in the UK, but his dad is from Cork, so he's in the Connacht Academy. So there are three guys there, I think, that are very exciting to watch. I just love when you see players with a ball in their hands and their first instinct is, how can I beat someone? How can I go at my opposite number? I want to run with the ball. Obviously, that doesn't always happen. And sometimes you have to kick the ball. But I just think, talking about Mac Hansen, I just like that he's a real natural footballer. His all-round game is very, very good. And, you know, you mentioned Andy Farrell brought him into the Irish squad. This is a guy that could play for Ireland and isn't a million miles away. And he's shown his quality with the tries he's scoring for Connacht. So really, really good signing. You know, it's hard to judge Shane Bolton the other night off what we saw, but he looks a balanced runner. He looks strong and he looks like he can play. And McNulty, as I said, at fullback, you know, wanted to join that line in attack and run hard. They're exciting players and they're good footballers that fit the style of the way Andy Friend wants to play. And they're three guys that could go on and play for Ireland.
And they've got that surety now with Jack Hartley as well, the new three-year contract, meaning they can sort of plan for the future with him there. And I thought his interview with Joe was interesting, of sort of the maturity he now seems to have, where we're always talking about Jack Hartley, he should be this, he should be that, and sort of taking it on his own shoulders that actually the reason he wasn't involved after the last World Cup was he went back to Connacht and he just didn't play well enough. I think he'd actually lost his place for a couple of the Champions Cup games. That, like, Hartley, over the next 2 or 3 years, we hope will force his way into a World Cup squad. But he, and having him at top form, could elevate Connacht to a whole other level.
Yeah, and look, it's Nathan. If the Connacht forwards get enough of quality ball and they match the opposition or beat the opposition forward pack, and you give Carty good quality ball, he's a brilliant player. He's a brilliant footballer. He makes mistakes, though, and I think that's the issue for him. And that was the issue since the World Cup. Consistent performances, doing the simple things really well. We know he's a natural kind of flair runner who is exciting, wants to attack with the ball. But you've got to do the basics really well as a fly half. Read the game, kick in the right areas, bring other people into the game, defend strong. So there's things still to improve for Jack Hartley, and he has that natural flair and ability, and I'm talking about a lot of these players who have that. But, you know, referring to Robbie Henshaw again, Ring Rose, Damien Diolinde, top class international players, it's that when you don't have the ball, there's small little things you see from an international player that separates them. It's that ruthless defensive edge that they have. It's that ability to go in and attack the breakdown. Not everybody can do that because of their size, but it's just been really rock solid in those parts and those moments that, you know, as a fly half, you're going to be attacked. The opposition are going to try and target you. And, you know, for Jack Carty, you know, he can't put on 10 kilos and be a big bashing out half, but small things just need to improve. And it's consistency, and that comes with confidence as well. So he's a confidence player, and it's a brilliant move for Connacht that he signed a new 3-year contract.
Before we let you go, Quinny, I don't think we've spoken to you about your Roy Keane dinner. It's always a worrying thing when you pick up the paper, I'd imagine, on a Sunday morning. Roy Keane has done a feature-length interview and you get a mention. But he did bring up a dinner with yourself and Rog and Paul O'Connell after he was spending some time with the All Blacks. And Rog's name obviously came up quite a bit and how they were going to target him. What are your memories of dinner with Roy Keane?
Excellent. It was brilliant. We had great fun, great chats. You know, obviously he gets portrayed as this ruthless kind of non-friendly person at times, and it was the complete opposite. We had he just completely opened up to us, and he was more keen and interested in how we were preparing for playing the All Blacks. He'd been in Cardiff to see us in the Heineken Cup final against Toulouse. He'd been in the Munster squad a couple of times over the years, so I think he was pretty relaxed with us, and we weren't asking him stupid questions and annoying him. He was the one who instigated the dinner. He told a lie that we tried to pay for the dinner, but I kind of snuck out on behalf of the group that was there, the lads, and he already had the dinner paid for. So it was very nice of him, but it was a lovely kind of intimate chat for probably 2 hours in Wellington in 2008. And obviously there's a real intrigue, and the boys tried to set me up with him then, saying that I was a Liverpool fan and that I was a friend of Niall Quinn.
All of which is true.
They were trying to create this narrative that I was anti Roy Keane in 2002 when he left the World Cup, and that. So they tried that, but he just laughed that off. But it was really interesting because he was great company. It was really brilliant. And I had actually chats with him a couple of years after that. We did an event in the Aviva Stadium, and we were staying at the Herbert Park Hotel. He left early, but he said to me, call in to me when you come back. And I remember going back to the hotel thinking, did he actually say, give him a shout in his room? I was trying to think about it in reception, and then someone asked the girl in reception, would she ring his room and see, did he actually tell me to call up? And this was about 11 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And he picked up the phone and said, Jack, come up. Knocked on his door. He was chatting to his wife on the phone and gestured for me to come in. And I ended up sitting there for two hours with him, chatting on my own. And so I've had chats with him, and I just think he's phenomenal, really. He is paranoid at times, and he openly says, you know, he struggles in big groups and big people harassing him, annoying him, and it's a different world for him. But it was intriguing having those chats and being in a relaxed situation and actually feeling that he's relaxed and he's the one asking you questions. So that was really interesting, yeah, for sure.
All right, good stuff, Quinny. We'll leave it there for today. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Cheers, lads. Thanks.
It's Alan Quinlan. You can get the podcast of that on the OTB Sports app. Subscribe to OTB Rugby, and our podcast should be back working on all platforms at the moment. Right, if you want to get in touch, 087 918 180 is the WhatsApp number. Here's what's on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold at 1 o'clock is Luke Keeney, the Donegal footballer. He talks through his horrific hip injury. State of the Union at 3 o'clock is our rugby series. The classic is the Brawl, the Meath Mayo Brawl, as it was correctly identified. Dr. Harry Edwards on OJ Simpson is OTB Gold at 6 tonight. A phenomenal interview with a really important character in American social history. And OTB tonight is live from 7 with Joe and the lads looking back at the weekend's activity. Up next, we're going to bring a reaction to the FAI Cup final. We're previewing Ireland versus Georgia with John Duggan in studio.
OTB AM.
It's probably the best feeling I've had in football, to be quite honest with you. Just in terms of like the way, obviously winning the league and the Cup a good few years ago now is obviously brilliant, but you might think sometimes that happens every year then, but to go on the sort of decline that we did, yeah, decline, but we went on a little bit of a slip over the last number of years, and just to come back here to captain this team, I said it to the lads before the game, it's an absolute honour to lead them out on the Aviva for this club in a cup final. It was probably the proudest day in my football career to do that, and obviously to come out on the winning side and to lift the trophy with a great friend of mine, Christy O'Neill, who's been here longer than me. It's just special. And to add to that, I had my first child on Friday, which it's probably all my dreams came true in a weekend. So I'm just, I can't believe it, to be quite honest with you. It's the best weekend in my life, to be honest.
That's pretty good. I hope the labour was fast. And that it was like, you know, a nice afternoon labour as opposed to late night. But so that's Ian Birmingham there in conversation with Enda Cole at the Aviva Stadium after St Patrick's Athletic won all draw after extra time, and they won on penalties against Bowes. His partner Leia and their daughter Pippa were back at home and watched him lift the trophy on the telly. John Duggan is with us this morning. John, good morning to you.
Jerry Nathan, how are we doing?
What's going on?
Well, I enjoyed the final and watched it at home, and I felt that the pitch was quite big. I wonder if the players found it a while to adjust to the pitch, and I didn't think the game was that great until extra time. Chris Forrester's goal was fantastic, and then obviously Rory Field equalised, and Stephen O'Donnell was talking in the press conference about how much they practice penalties, and that obviously paid off in the shootout when they got 4-3. So he's been linked with Dundalk this morning. Dan McDonald's got a piece in the Indo about that, and Steve Staunton as well in another paper being linked with the Dundalk job, which is interesting to see. But look, 37,000 fans, there's definitely something brewing on Irish football from a positive point of view. Great to see it. That's a record attendance for the Aviva, and I'm delighted to see that. And I think next season will be fantastic with Damien Duff on this touchline, with Jack Byrne back in the league. And we can identify, hopefully, given all the amazing sports journalism that was done in the last few days about these people that play for these clubs, and hearing the stories like Ian Birmingham there, and there'll be hopefully much more stories to come. So that's very much a true fact. That's a statement of fact. I also think it's also true to say that the thuggery that we saw outside the Irish Town House was appalling, and can't be just glossed over and brushed under the carpet. Obviously, there's a very small minority of gougers were involved in throwing bottles and punches and flares, and the Gardaí will investigate, and hopefully they're going to identify who these people were and get this stamped out of the game. Because I recently lived in Irish Town for 18 months. I walked past that venue every single day. I've never seen a moment's trouble, day or night. And it was just pretty sickening to see the stuff that I saw on social media. That can exist as a true fact, as well as the occasion being a great as well.
Yeah, you just need to make sure that the policing is excellent.
There's a police station around the corner from that, like literally around the corner, a few hundred yards. So what was happening there is a question that needs to be asked too.
Well, it's clear that this was premeditated. They're turning up in balaclavas. There's no question.
Everybody's got a balaclava now though, right?
They've no question they knew what they were doing. And I think you're right, it can't be glossed over. And I'm sure there will be charges and investigations, and anybody who's around the clubs, and if anything comes out that, you know, people who are members of the clubs knew that this was happening, well, action needs to be taken. At the same time, I don't think it should overshadow completely what happened yesterday with the crowd that was there, with the match, with the progress that's been made, and that a reputation, an unfair reputation around Irish football can be allowed to take hold, that hooliganism is a part of Irish football. It's just not. These isolated issues happen where people take advantage of a situation to associate them with the club, to basically let themselves have a scrap and act whatever way they want. Like, this does not happen week in, week out in Irish football. It just doesn't.
It is there, though. It was there yesterday, though. I've never seen anything like that around Croke Park. Imagine people throwing bottles outside Gills on Lord Arden final day. It'd be on live line for the next month.
I'm not sure. I think that I don't think it's a football specific thing, is it? Like, is this not just, like, if you are outside any chippers in any small town in Ireland, there's a fight at the weekends. Like, that's, you know, how's that different? I think the comparison with other sports is a fairly easy, I've seen a lot of GAA people make that comparison on Twitter over the last
few years. Well, the argument we made that the violence in the GAA happens inside the grounds,
if there was thuggery on a GAA pitch, and there is an awful lot of it in Gaelic football especially, at club level,
it doesn't really get talked about, does it?
No, but if there was, and it would happen yesterday, I'd say exactly the same thing about the GAA or about the rugby. So I just felt, I was just a little bit disturbed by what I saw on social media yesterday with those videos, and I'd rather not have seen it. And if we can have a situation where these things don't happen again, that's great. That's the only reason to call it out.
I think it needs to be policed properly, and I think that the clubs need to come out and make very strong statements about it, and the FAI needs to make a strong statement about it to show that there is a united front. And then we need to hear what the policing is going to be, like how much are they trying to infiltrate the level of organisation that was going on, how organised was what happened yesterday. Like, that's the type of stuff that you need to find out. So, but I don't think that it's endemic in League of Ireland football at all. And
there have been previous isolated incidents, and there's been issues around the Lewis, around some of the Dublin derbies. But again, you have to get ahead of this. Like, 20, 30 lads didn't just rock up in Irish town unannounced and all randomly run into each other and think, oh, who knew there was a Pat's event on, a Pat's family event happening in the pub. They were talking to each other. You need to have that bit of intelligence to know, police intelligence to know that something here could possibly happen. Are we ready to ensure it doesn't, no matter what? So something went awry yesterday, and they need to make sure that this is a one-off, that it doesn't happen again. Because, you know, as John said, I think there's definitely momentum behind the league. People are getting into that routine and that habit of a Friday night of going to matches. And we know that a lot of stadiums, the facilities aren't great, but you need to make sure that the match day experience is a safe one.
Yeah, otherwise you're not going to convince the families to go, and that's the big breakthrough for the league. A reminder, OTB AM live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. What else is going on, John?
Well, Man United, Chelsea was the big other story yesterday, and I watched the cup final ahead of that. Obviously saw the highlights later on in the day. Interesting that he left Ronaldo on the bench. And, well, another thing I observed is the Manchester United football industry, it's not going to stop. It's like Gary Neville tweeting out that he felt that Rangnick picked the team, and then Carrick denied that, and then Roy Keane's having his usual rant on an evening, and it's highly entertaining on Sky Sports. I'm not really too enamoured with Carrick's appraisal of the performance. Look, United were much more structured. They played McFred and Matic. They had Sancho, who's obviously coming into a good vein of form now in the team. But Chelsea still had two-thirds of the ball. They still had, 24 shots to 3. They should still have won the game. I think Timo Werner is still an issue with Chelsea.
Yeah.
Obviously, couple of chances missed. And they can't get Lukaku back in there quickly enough. But I suppose more of the issue for Chelsea was the fact that they were missing Conte, possibly. But you know,
Morata off Werner, isn't there? There's just that piece of him that you're never convinced.
No, it's like, cut your losses.
Well, it could be worse. You could have 11 players like Tottenham have at the moment that are not convincing. But look, the Ronaldo Rangnick thing is going to be absolutely fascinating to see, because is Ronaldo now going to be an occasional player for United, given he scored 10 goals in 15 games since joining the club? It's a real way up dilemma at the moment between that and the style that Rangnick's going to bring. But one thing, I'm looking at the table this morning. There are three clubs and three managers so far ahead of everybody else, like Chelsea, City, and Liverpool, Tuchel, Guardiola, and Klopp, and then there's the rest.
The business side is obviously fascinating at United, and Andy Mitten said earlier that basically Cristiano Ronaldo was just landed upon the footballing side of the club, that it was a business decision, a commercial decision, and he got him back in the team. That from a George Mendes point of view, like, the money for Ronaldo is by moving. That actually, if it was to fall apart and if he was to somehow get a move in January, from Cristiano Ronaldo, George Mendes point of view, maybe it works out just fine. They've got their signing on fee already. Manchester United have had an initial boost at a time when they needed a little bit of something, a little bit of stardust. Cristiano Ronaldo came in, everybody got excited.
Well, somebody made the point that they were protecting their advertising legacy so that they don't have him in a Manchester City jersey. That's gone now. City aren't going to sign him. They're not going to take him after this.
That conversation surely has to be happening now before Rangnick is announced as to what happens, because he can't come in and say, yeah, Ronaldo, I'll give him his opportunities, then 2 days into training say, actually, this just isn't going to work.
He can pretend to give him his opportunity, give him some opportunities in the less important games, and then for the big games, never pick him, and then Ronaldo picks the fight. There's like...
Is there a possibility that Ronaldo could press? Is there a possibility that he hasn't had a manager who's over the past
he's
5, 6
enough.
Years?
Like, Ronaldo is one of the fittest players out there.
Well, compare him to... And I know Messi got a hat-trick of assists yesterday, but Messi's performance where
he was walking the other day.
He literally walked through the game against Manchester City. Now, maybe that was part of Pochettino's tactics, but you do feel Ronaldo can offer a lot more than that. Again, to contradict myself, I thought the last half an hour yesterday that United's little press that they have fell apart once Ronaldo came on, because all he wants is the ball in a position where he can do damage. Does he actually, at this age of his career, is he willing to sacrifice himself for the team and tire himself out? Again, even though he's only out for half an hour, think back to the two Ireland games, the goals, the chance at the end. He loves those last couple of minutes where everyone else is getting tired and he's still got his energy and he gets his goals.
Whereas actually, if you're saying, I'm going to start you in this game, I'll probably take you off after an hour because you're going to run yourself into the ground. Is he thinking... Well,
one of the interesting things about Rangnick is, look, he's been a guy who's worked with underdog teams, Hoffenheim and Schalke and RB Leipzig, obviously his technical director. He's got one German cup to his name. He's walking into a big global beast here. He's walking into a dressing room with Ronaldo and Pogba when he comes back in, if Pogba's going to stay at the club. Managing the egos and managing these kind of, like, it'd be much easier to manage Greenwood and Rashford and Sancho and all these lads with the style of play than it's going to be easy to manage Cristiano Ronaldo. And it's a big issue. It's the biggest issue Rangnick has when he arrives at the club.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see exactly what happens, and hopefully there'll be an announcement today. It's kind of what we expect at some point, that they will confirm this, although Andy Mitten was non-committal a little bit earlier on, kind of leaving just that little wiggle room that maybe this isn't the done deal that we all think it is, although in all the papers, who have clearly been briefed by senior staff at Manchester United, that does seem to be the case. John, good stuff. Thanks a million.
All right, folks. Mind yourselves.
Nathan, the Republic of Ireland are in action tomorrow night.
Yes.
Vera Powell's team kind of now in a must-win game.
Oh, this is absolutely must-win. I spoke to Vera Powell after the draw with Slovakia on Thursday. She said herself, this is must-win. Georgia are by far and away the worst team in this group. You look back at their last campaign, they lost every match. They conceded 14 goals against Denmark. They had 7-8-0 defeats along the way as well. This is a goal game Ireland need to win, but also I think win convincingly. Score some goals, play some nice attacking football. The performance against Slovakia was hugely disappointing. If Ireland don't qualify, they could come back to look at that night as a huge 2 points dropped. Slovakia have been a right pain in the ass for everybody they've played. Sweden struggled to beat them, but beat them. Finland struggled to beat them, but beat them. The point means that Ireland still have that slight advantage over Finland because they went to Finland and won, but you know, does mean that they're not in as comfortable a position as they were. And I think it was the performance that we thought that Ireland were about to kick on again, but the same old issues. Couldn't get Denise O'Sullivan on the ball enough and couldn't get Katie McCabe on the ball, and playing as a left back in a team that is on the back foot just doesn't seem to get the best out of Katie McCabe. And, you know, Vera Powell seemed to have a little bit of a dig at her and a couple of the Irish players after the game for the goal, that they lost a run of themselves. I mean, players who don't stick in their positions, who want to do too much, and Katie McCabe was obviously caught out of position for the goal. You wonder what the relationship is like there. And I think Vera Powell, I think if Ireland didn't win tomorrow night, like, that would may well be that for Vera Powell. But I think they will win and win convincingly, but she doesn't seem to have figured out how to get the best out of Katie McCabe and doesn't seem to trust the talented players in the squad. Where have we been before where this might have been the case in Irish football? Doesn't seem to trust the technical players. Like Katie McCabe, and you know, Emma Byrne was on co-commentary, who knows Katie McCabe well. Like Katie McCabe, it's fine at Arsenal because it's a star-studded team that she plays on the left-hand side. But for Ireland, they don't have that. They need to get her in a position where she's on the ball more than anybody else.
So where is that? Is that a 4-2-3-1 and she's in the middle of the forward three?
Maybe she's on, yeah, exactly. So sort of playing as a number 10 perhaps, or maybe just even slightly deeper. But then you're going to have McCabe and O'Sullivan close together. And you could see McCabe herself said every time O'Sullivan gets on the ball, McCabe tries to do something. She makes a run because she knows that O'Sullivan has the ability to pick her out. But like, they connected probably 2-3 times during that game. One of them obviously for the goal. But yeah, it was very, very flat in difficult conditions on Thursday night. And you know, they have huge regrets from the last campaign and the defeat to Ukraine. You just hope it's not the same again. But I think tomorrow night they'll win. There'll have to be changes. Heather Payne has had to go back to America because she's in college. So they'll have to make a change up top. I think they should make a change at the back. With, you know, do you need to play three at the back at home against Georgia and play Katie McCabe on the left-hand side? I hope as well it's not totally overshadowed tomorrow by what happens with Stephen Kenny over the next 24 hours, because there is an FAI board meeting today as well. And it seems Stephen Kenny's going to be offered a new contract at the end of that. The question is, what contract is he going to be offered? The reports seem to suggest he may just be offered something like a 6-month contract extension. That means he doesn't just get the first four Nations League games, that actually he gets the full six. But if they don't go well, that he end up changing manager right
before
on the eve
of
the World Cup qualifiers. Now, Stephen Kenny said himself he wants to go and win that Nations League group, but it just seems, again, very
short-sighted
and would put him under, like, Vinnie Perth gave a very good example, he felt, in that game against Portugal where Pepe was sent off. He said that Stephen Kenny, if he's comfortable in his position, instantly makes an attacking change, instantly goes and tries to win that game. But because he's thinking, I can't afford to lose this, he delays and he delays. And as bullish as he's been around the Nations League campaign, you don't want to be in a situation where you're going into games not thinking about winning, because I pointed out before, I think if Ireland win that group, not only is he guaranteed the Euros campaign, I think you might be looking at getting the World Cup campaign out of it as well, because you'll get your qualification, you'll get big games. You don't want to be going into matches against, you know, Sweden, Norway, thinking we need to be ultra defensive, can't afford to lose.
Yeah,
you want to be going in thinking we want to win.
What would the long term point from the FAI's perspective be for not having the person who's in charge of the Nations League games take charge of the games for the world, the next qualifiers?
Well, I guess their concern would be what happened in the last Nations League. Now, we know there was extenuating circumstances with COVID. There's a repetition of what happened against Luxembourg and Azerbaijan, and it falls apart, and suddenly they've done the John Delaney trick of offering a long-term contract to a manager who's lost four out of his six Nations League games. Remember, Ireland are one of, what, a handful of teams who've never won a Nations League game through two campaigns.
We're suddenly, as a football society, saying this group of games, which all the previous managers have used as fodder for building a squad, we're now saying that's the most important thing.
Well, Stephen Kenny said that himself. But I think he's right. I think we should be taking these games seriously. I don't think the Nations League is a time for experimentation. It's a huge opportunity for a country like the Republic of Ireland. But you're putting an added layer of pressure on the manager and the team by saying, well, unless, like, so is the contract negotiation, if you win that group, you're getting a new contract for the Euros campaign? If you avoid utter humiliation, you're getting a new contract? Like, what's the baseline then?
It doesn't make any sense, because...
Are you in a scenario again where you lose your first two matches but you win the next four? So does that get you a contract because your victories were at the end? Or if you start well but finish poorly?
If I was Stephen Kenny, I'd say no thanks. No thanks. I'm off. Off you go. Either you back me or you don't back me. And if you don't back me, if you half back me, if we're all going to pretend that we're a little bit pregnant here in this scenario, then no thanks. John Duggan's still with us, actually. John, what do you think?
I think that the FAI are not as important as they think they are, and they need to prove themselves just as much as Stephen Kenny does. The most important factors in the Stephen Kenny project are the buy-in of the players and the fans. He has that. The players have all come out and said that publicly, four or five of them, including newer players like Josh Cullen, Seamus Coleman, Shane Duffy, Jason Knight. They've all come out and said that. Secondly, we'd a full house against Qatar and a full house against Portugal, and people are bought into the entertaining style of play. You're already going to build something for many years. He's got hardly, like Jeff Hendrick, Omo Bamidele, Ida, none of them started in the Premier League at the weekend. We don't have players like Damien Duff, John O'Shea, Robbie Keane, Shea Given playing at the top level in English football anymore. These are the raw materials he has to work with. You're only going to build something for the next few years, or you're just going to have to stop-start the situation at all. And like, if the FAI offered him a short-term contract, I did the whole Brian Kerr campaign in 2005. There was a sword of Damocles hanging over him with his contract, and it filtered into, it seeped into the team. Whereas at the Switzerland game, which we needed to win, we played poorly. And you can't have this week-by-week question marks over Stephen Kenny. Future. It's just madness.
Every single match becomes a referendum. Yeah, every single press conference
also, look at the nonsense that has happened over the last couple of years. We know that there are people around that team who don't want Stephen Kenny there. Not within the squad, but there are those around. We've seen the stories that leak out constantly trying to undermine him. If you're already undermining him again by offering a short-term contract, expect more of the same. And people do want him. As John said, the matches are sold out. People want Stephen Kenny to get that backing. And it makes zero sense for the FAI to just offer that short-term deal. Make the commitment through to the end of the next campaign.
Also, you can pay off a contract. I know they're broke, but you can pay off a contract. If it's not working out, pay off the contract.
They can't afford to pay off the contract because they don't have a sponsor, because Stephen Kenny lost some games and that's why they can't get a sponsor.
Yeah, but that's not true.
Stephen Kenny is the reason why they get a sponsor, because the brand is good.
As we saw from Jill Downey on Twitter, who runs sponsorship for Core, one of the biggest advertising agencies in the country, she was making the point that people believe in the football team and they believe in the quality of the experience of watching this football team now, which is the first time in a long time, and that is a very sponsorable thing. And if I was sponsoring it and I was putting £1 million in a year, or 2 million, or 1.5 million, or whatever it is, I'd want to know this guy's going to be my manager for the next campaign at least. So not in the middle of it you're like, oh, we might have Neil Lennon coming in, or we might have Chris Hughton coming in.
Big Sam,
I don't know. That's, you know,
like the different tangent. The Irish team is rife for a sponsorship at the moment when you look at the players that are coming through and what you want the Irish football team
and the style,
represent.
The bravery. Right.
I think Jonathan Hill needs to go and force this through. I know it's not his decision completely, but he's obviously given them the backing. Needs to say, commercially, football wise, the sensible thing to do is to offer him the contract till the end of the Euros campaign.
Yeah.
Sounds like something the Dublin lot would say, though, Ger.
OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Do you want to explain that reference quickly?
Roy Keane was down in Kerry on Friday night. He was doing a major fundraiser. I know Mick Galway was on with you on Saturday. Mick Galway was down there as well. He was asked about Stephen Kenny. Roy, in his usual wit, I think he knew what crowd he was playing to. I thought football was about winning matches. But he said Stephen Kenny has the backing of the media, particularly the Dublin lot.
Johnny Ward with us in studio tomorrow morning, live on OTBAM, building up to Ireland, Georgia, coming to you, as I said, live on Tuesday evening, and much more as well. If you've missed anything from the show this morning, you'll get it all back on the OTBAM podcast feed. The best place to do that is the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.